Hello and welcome to the Pit Imps Podcast, brought to you by the Brainstorm Brewery. On a very, very special episode, at least for us, because, you know, we're all about tournament coverage, and this is the Pro Tour coverage episode. I am your host, Angelo, and this week I'm here with Brother Ryan.
What up, what up?
And the last one from the Pit Imps posse gambit of episodes that we was going to do, we have Mike Hardy with us.
How's it going, guys?
Yay! I'm
just glad the dart saved the best for last, you know.
There we go. I'm excited to have you on, man. Long time listener, long time family member. It's all fucking love here with us. Yeah, dude, I was pumped when your name was called.
You want to know a sad secret? I had to throw that last dart like 9 times before I hit a piece of paper. I came so close to so many other pieces of paper, like, and I'd go up to it and be like, nope, that's just off the edge of the paper, not him. And I just kept having to throw it, and finally it did land on yours.
But the dart knew where it had to go. I mean, you can't question fate. It just happens.
Or be throwing darts while drinking.
As long as the kids weren't in the room, then, you know, that's perfectly safe.
And you're not throwing the darts at the kid. You're good.
Well, see, with kids, they just run in circles around a room, so the dart's probably going to be heading towards them at some point, so...
I do keep it right next to my chair. You know what I mean? They get out of hand. Shut up!
I'm still trying to patent the tranquilizer gun for kids.
It has been. It was called Ritalin.
Yeah. Or children's Tylenol.
Oh, yes. Tylenol PM. 6 of them. Take them, kids. Enjoy. Okay, to get a little serious here, this was the Pro Tour. This is our big deal as far as our episodes go, because this is, you know, we consider ourselves the sports center of Magic. And yes, during the GPs and the SCGs, it gets a little stale for us. There's no question about that. But when it comes to Pro Tours, you're getting the true coverage. So we're going to start out with day one. And in my eyes, the story of day one clearly was Andrea Mengucci.
In your eyes, I think that is the story in everybody's eyes, man.
Well, no, there could be another story. I mean, two people did finish undefeated today on the, yes, on day. So, I mean, that's anybody who follows those people more would consider them the story.
So 349 players.
Yes.
And the story of the day, yeah, I'd have to agree with you. Andrea Mengucci beating last PT champion Sean McLaren in round one to take the King of the Hill seat. And he ran the King of the Hill seat all the way up until the last round.
He sure did.
Pretty impressive.
Yeah, it was very impressive. Coming into this tournament, he had a few Pro Tour qualifications, and he had a career record of 29 and 28.
He had 4 PT day twos.
Yeah, he had a career record of 29 and 28. So this is not somebody who's just going, you expect to light the world on fire or anything. This is somebody who's shown up a few times, never done really well. He's always been, you know, kind of middle of the pack at best. With a record like 29 and 28, there's no question that that's what he was. Nobody really saw this coming. He switched teams from his Italian team to actually play with a few Americans. And I don't know if it was the shock of the change. He said the actual play testing wasn't much different, but he clearly did something there. I mean, something clearly happened for him where he just, something clicked, and maybe this is just his format. Who knows? But he rocked day one, going 7-1 until eventually losing in the very last round of day one.
Yeah.
To Patrick Chapin, a Hall of Famer. And there's absolutely no shame in that.
Nothing at all.
And to be fair, man, seeing that match was, to me, the epitome of someone who you kind of described, Angelo, as like, you know, middle of the pack, makes the Pro Tour. Obviously a great Magic player, but at the pro level, not really head and shoulders above anybody. And that match between him and Chapin, how Chapin was able to, it wasn't even that Chapin beat him in the game itself. It's that he beat him mentally and got the guy to tilt.
Yeah, it was really weird. Like, Mengucci decided he was going to take a very aggressive line.
Yeah.
He decided that, okay, there's essentially one out that Chapin could have to beat me. I have 5 points of damage and burn in my hand that I can play next turn. So he has to top deck a courser and a land be on top of it for him not to die. So what happens? He top decks exactly that and puts him just out of range of the burn, and he had the board clogged enough that Mengucci was not going to get any damage in, and he really took that hard. And then later he actually made a misplay where he aimed a, believe it was a lightning strike at something that had no damage on it.
He threw a lightning strike at a courser of Kruphix that he thought
had one damage on it, but had nothing.
And had blocked it, but had blocked a soldier token with it, and he had not.
Yes.
So
then he picked up his cards, went to game two, and game two just did not go well. Like, he just, you could just see him just frustrated. He kept probably a bad hand, and he just did not play well.
He wanted out of there. Pretty fucking crazy. Chapin showed his mastery, though. Guy was fucking brilliant.
And Chapin's one of those guys who has, like, where he announces everything he's doing, and it'll throw you off your game, but he's so crisp and clean with his plays that he's very, very unlikely to make a mistake.
He's very good. He's not a pro that you can ever, that I could say of other pros that you can accuse of keeping awkward board states, and as far as not being clear about what the board state is, what's happening to what, that sort of thing. Yeah, you're dead on about that. He really does do.
I guess that's what you get for 17 years on the pro tour, though, give or take.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you count as juniors, you're about right, because for his years he was in the junior pro tour, and that was basically the same deal.
Yeah, I mean, Chapin is a guy, I mean, his first PT top eight was 17 years ago.
Yeah.
Which is insane. And I made my prediction after that match that I ended up being right on. I just, yeah.
Okay, 17 minutes, 55 seconds.
Uh-oh, is that an edit point?
Yes, that is.
My bad. Leave it to me.
Yeah, I figured it wouldn't take long. You already jumped in before I asked you to, too. So.
Yeah, pretty crazy.
All right, hold up a second, and we'll get started again. Yeah, so that ended up, that was basically the end of round one, or day one, I'm sorry, not round one. And here was how the top 20 broke down after the first day. We had Patrick Chapin and Josh Utter-Layton, both carrying a record of 8-0. We had numerous 7-1s all the way down to 11th place, and those are Joel Larson, Todd Anderson, Darwin Castle, Andrea Mangucci, Reed Duke, Eduardo Sanchez Guiardo, Jared Betcher, Marcelo.
Without his Pokemon hat too, Jared Betcher.
Yep. And Andrew Beckstrom. Those were our 11, or those are our 7-1s. We had 2 6-1-1s, and that was Shota Takao and Yuya Watanabe. And then, 6-2s, there was a bunch of these. These went all the way down to 49th place. However, with tiebreakers breaking down to the top 20, it was Stu Summers, Dan Jordan, Vidianto Wajaya, Jason Ellis, Eli Pilsen. It's from another country, and the way they spell it and the way they pronounce it is sometimes just not the way I see it. And Guillaume Wafatapa and Paul Rietzel. So a pretty stacked top 20 at the end of day one.
Very stacked. Todd Anderson with his best start of a PT was kind of impressed there. I don't like the guy, but whatever. Good play. Chapin and Utter-Layton were no surprise at the 2 8-0s.
The Raptors probably, and I truly believe he's the best player in the world. The rankings might not say it, but I believe
Reed Duke, I think Reed Duke is a lot better than Raptor, but.
Reed got a hell of a lot better when he started testing.
I don't know. When the pros say who the best player in the world is, they always say Reed Duke. I'm yet to hear one say it's Josh Utter-Layton.
Oh, I've heard a lot of people say.
Just saying. I've never heard a pro say that.
LSV.
I heard three or four people on coverage this weekend, pros, including Chapin, refer to Reed Duke as the best player in the world. Owen Turtenwald said it on the weekend. Chapin said
Owen Turtenwald's his best friend. So, but I've heard LSV say that. Paulo say that Aptor's the best in the world. I mean, these guys who test with them originally, I mean, they all flat out say that they're not going to come up with these decks or be where they need to be if it wasn't for him first and foremost.
Well, his team wasn't even the big one. He just tested with Team Channel Fireball this time around, which surprised me that he wasn't with Pantheon, but yeah.
I mean, he's always been with CFE.
CFE. That's his team. That's been his team for years.
I just thought with the influx of all the new guys and I thought Pantheon, just that group there, I thought looking at over the two lists that Pantheon I thought was a better fit for him. But yeah.
Well, isn't the Pantheon just a bunch of Hall of Famers plus Reed Duke and Turtenwald? Like, isn't that, it's like Huey's like, all right, I'll come on your team, but I got to bring my buds. And they're like, okay.
Yeah, sure. That's what it is. Yeah. I think you nailed that down absolutely perfect. So after round 11, they showed us this cool video. And guys, we're just going to have to shoot the shit about this because Conspiracy looks fucking awesome.
Yeah, for sure. Looks like a lot of fun. I was giving it a lot of shit. I'm not a big fan of these like draft only sets, and I just think they're like kind of gimmicky and just another way for
having these sets. When did they ever put one of these out?
Unglued, Unhinged.
Unglued and Unhinged were not draft only. They just weren't standard.
Well, yeah, not standard legal. That's what I mean. Like, and you can't use Unhinged or Unglued even in Vintage or Legacy. It's pretty much sealed only. It's a sealed only casual thing. And same with this. I feel it's just a gimmick for them to make money or whatever. And, at least maybe this time we're getting, I mean, we are getting some cards like that we can actually, you know, we can use Conspiracy from what I know in Legacy and Vintage. I mean, Dak Faden's in Conspiracy, right?
Yeah, we'll get into the spoilers a little later. But yeah, I mean, it just looked like good fun. And to be real honest, like Unhinged and Unglued, yeah, I guess those were like sealed things, but this is more a draft thing. And as a drafter,
it's definitely made for draft format because there's cards that have specific, you know, things that happen while you're drafting. And yeah, this looks like a ton of fun though. The video, I mean, you guys should definitely check it out. I don't know. Angelo will probably post the link in the show notes, but it seemed cool. It was, I liked how they described it as it's going to be a format where like everybody at the table probably at one point or another is going to get to be the bad guy. Right. I mean, the power swings were so fun to watch.
The thing that really struck me with the video was they had this eclectic mix of players in it from, you know, kind of casuals to judges to pros to streamers. And all
Chris
of them.
Clue.
Yeah, Chris Clue, professional football player. They all, definitely looked like they were having a ton of fun playing it. Like they were all, you know, just almost throwing, you know, peanuts and pretzels at each other while drinking a beer. It just seems like that kind of format, you know, where you sit down with your buddies at the kitchen table and you just, you know, crack open a box, draft, have fun, yell at each other. It just looks like a blast.
Yeah, I mean, I, as somebody who plays a lot of drafts, I've never had the set that reminds me of Limited's EDH. And this is kind of what this does to me. It's the thing that actually wants me to have some friends over to sit down and just play Magic and drink some beers and have a blast, which, you know, constructed players have that with EDH, but as a limited player, I haven't had nothing for years. And like Ryan said, there was Unhinged and Unglued, but I mean, those were years ago. I've had nothing that's made me want to actually play casually since then. And now I actually do. It's really cool. I mean, I'm going to buy multiple boxes of these. Like there's no question about it.
Yeah, this is almost your like plane chase or your arch enemy, but for the drafter instead of the casual constructed player. So I think it's a really cool idea. And the way it's looking to shape up, it just looks friggin' amazing. Like I can't wait to crack open a box and play.
Yeah, the conspiracy cards, the actual cards with the card type conspiracy and no casting cost, they really look to shake things up where you name a card that's in your deck. And then once you play that card, you get to flip your conspiracy and do all these crazy fucking things. It's kind of like arch enemy meets draft meets drunken idiots.
You can do with some of those cards, like start the game with, wasn't there one in the video, Marshall had that he like started the game with like tokens already on board. This is crazy.
Yeah, there was one of them that had, they got to put in a bird token, like when the game started. And it was like, what the hell?
Yeah, just weird stuff, man, like that. And that, turn zero creature is, that's powerful.
That's, and that's a point that Marshall made too. He's like, how do I draft this? What do I know? How powerful are these free effects? You know, and it's like, for somebody from, you know, like Marshall who just talks limited nonstop, it was kind of interesting to watch him kind of piece it together. Like, okay, I know how to draft, but this is kind of throwing a wrench into everything.
His whole strategy seemed to revolve around grabbing all the conspiracy cards.
Yeah, you gotta admit, it was funny watching their game, and it was like him, Kenji, a level 4 judge and the chick from Loading Ready Run, and the chick from Loading Ready Run wins. It was like, not who I expected to actually win that game.
In pretty hilarious fashion, I will say. So,
oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. I really enjoyed the video. Please, people, I will post this in the show notes. Go ahead and watch it. And a little bit later in the show, we'll actually go over what some of these cards actually were. But right now, it's time to get to day two. So
day two, yay!
Day two, you know, they started the day out the same as they did day one. They drafted for 3 rounds. Some people got tossed after those 3 rounds. Some people hung in there to get pro points, but were basically out of it. And then they did 5 rounds of block constructed. Day two, the biggest news story that really came out of day two, short of who our top eight is, which we ain't going to get into yet, was the fact that Jared Betcher for the most part, has locked up Rookie of the Year. Like, it's going to be hard for anybody to catch him at this point. He has two pro tours that he's been to this year, and one of them he finished, I want to say, ninth, and the other one, it's like 11th. So, I mean, I don't know how you catch him. It's actually 9th and 10th. And the other people who are in the running have not yet qualified for GP or for Pro Tour Portland. So I don't see how anyone can catch him by the end of the year, to be honest. Ryan, I know you're not happy with the guy, but you know, that's a hell of an accomplishment.
Oh, it's not that I'm not happy with him.
You just don't like him.
I just hate the fucking Pokemon hat. You're a grown ass dude. That shit's lame as fuck. But he did it without the Pokemon hat. So yeah.
So you can respect that.
He took the fucking hat off. Hopefully somebody talked to him and was like, look, dude, you're playing at Pro Tour. Lose the fucking hat.
You know what it might have been? And I hate to, you know, say this. It might have been Wizards themselves going, you're not allowed to promote another product while at our Pro Tour.
You know what? That could very well make a lot of sense. That could totally make sense.
I saw on Twitter what they refer to as the Kibler rule, which is you can no longer at a Pro Tour level event have deck sleeves for a different game. Because Kibler always used the Soulforge sleeves. But I mean, it makes sense for them having their top level competition. They don't want to promote other games or anything, even if it's just something as small as a deck sleeve, you know, with the little logo. But, you know, it's completely possible that they told them to lose the hat because it says Pokemon, which is one of, you know, their lesser competitors in the TCG market.
Yeah, I actually believe that's probably what it was, but you know what? He's had two good finishes without the hat now, so if that was his lucky charm, maybe he can lose it. Maybe he won't. I don't know. The dude has been playing nuts magic, though, this year for somebody who's just stepped onto the Pro Tour.
Maybe he just converted the hat into underwear, and we just don't see it anymore.
Yeah, he did finish ninth at the last Pro Tour.
So. Yeah, and he finished 10th at this one. So
I mean, that's nuts. Like, just as like an FNM player, just to think of getting to the Pro Tour is like the achieving glory. So to go 9th and 10th in your first two Pro Tours, like, Rookie of the Year is so hard because not only are you playing against these caliber pros, but then you have to qualify again. So just, I think it's a pretty amazing accomplishment for somebody to go 9 and 10 back to back in their rookie season.
Oh yeah. Very impressive. He's on a tear like,
Raymond. That 9th and 10th actually qualified him for, platinum status. So he's guaranteed for the rest of this season.
I do want to say, I mean, as good of a story as that is, I kind of felt like the day two story had to be, some combination of just how dominant, like, cards like Elspeth, Prognostic Sphinx, and
Courser of Kruphix, Sylvan Carrotid.
I mean, I think the Courser Kruphix was the story of the day on day two. It was fucking everywhere.
Yeah, I would say the story of the tournament in the end was the mana base of Courser of Kruphix and Sylvan Carrotid. Like, all good decks had that.
I'm gonna go with Joe Fiorini and call this Pro Tour Elspeth. I think Elspeth was far and away, it's the most powerful card in this block, and it was far and away the most powerful card in this tournament.
Which brought some very interesting, cards actually into play. Like, Prognostic Sphinx was everywhere just because Elspeth can't kill it.
Yeah, and it's a good answer to Elspeth, and Prognostic Sphinx is a great fucking card. You know me, I've said it a million times. I've been on that card's nuts forever, and I think it will be a huge player in the next standard season after Ravnica and shit rotates out.
I'm not ready to say that until I see what type of board sweepers we have, because, you know, like, this format doesn't really have a good board sweeper. Like, no one was running Faded Retribution. Why? You know what I mean? Like,
that's why. I did see it in some sideboards. I think Prognostic Sphinx too, if we get a good Wrath, if they bring us back like Wrath of God, it's gonna be at 4, and you drop this on 5.
Fair, but when you're playing a limited on limited game, it's just a bad card because it's gonna get swept off.
Yeah.
That's why it's not played now, is because of Supreme Verdict. You know, it just...
Well, it's not played now because there's just better answers. And maybe it's not played now because people just haven't got on it. Huey Jensen says it's the best card in blue-white control, and nobody runs it in blue-white control right now. I think... I've said it before, there's a reason a Hall of Famer says the card's really good. It's because the card's really good. People just aren't running it right now. I run 2 in my blue-white control, and I've never been unhappy with it. Not once, ever.
If you get one attack out of it, it's done its job.
It's fucking awesome. Watching Shaheen Serrani at one point with his Esper control deck scry 12.
Yeah.
Get 4 on the table, it's fucking insane. The card's fucking nuts, dude. I'd be really shocked if it's not like a major player in the next standard format. Like, we know Courser of Krufix will be.
Oh yeah, Courser. Like, I mean, if you have copies of Courser now, keep them. If you don't have them, buy them while they're still relatively cheap, because come next format, it's just going to be the best card draw in the format. Like, that is the big thing that came out of this tournament. Like, green is going to be played everywhere in the future, because unless we get a great draw card from the next set, Khans of Trokir, we're not getting it. That's it. So, like, buy those cards now. Don't let them get out of range, you know. Once people stop drafting them, they're going to go up. Speaking of Shaheen Ryan, you know, friend of the show, he's been on here. He finished 52nd and walked away with $1,000. So congrats to him.
Yeah, for sure.
So our final standings as far as day two goes, for 9th through 20th, again, I'm leaving the top eight out of it for now.
You suspenseful monster.
I know, it's so terrible.
Want to mention our top records at the end of day two?
No, we'll get into that when we go over who the top eight were. Joel Larson, 11-4-1. Jared Betcher, 11-4-1. That's 9th and 10th. Ben Friedman at 11th, 11-4-1. All of these are going to be 11-4-1. So if to make the top eight, you finish better than 11-4-1. Stu Summers, Paul Rietzel, number 19 in the world. Tom Martell, number 7 in the world. Eric Froelich, 22nd in the world. Michael Majors, Frank Dubuis, Carlos Moral, Chris Fennell, 23rd in the world, and Andrew Cuneo, rounding out the top 20. Now, to be honest, I can make a bonkers top 8 out of that.
Even just the top 16, like 9 to 16, would make a pretty respectable top 8.
Yeah, that's pretty bonkers, actually. If you say Joel Larson, Jared Betcher, Ben Friedman, Stu Summers, Paul Rietzel, Tom Martell, Eric Froelich, and Michael Majors, yeah, I'm down with that. I could watch that. No problem. Let them play cards.
All very, very good players. I think the coverage said it a lot this weekend. I think, Angelo, you maybe mentioned before, block is a pro format.
Yes, I
was really disappointed in what I thought was like a lack of innovation from the pros, but the cream definitely rose to the crop in this tournament. It's definitely a format where the pros just come and really, you know, stand out.
It is. The one thing that block usually does that is kind of different than most other formats, because it's just not played unless you play a lot of MTGO and you actually choose to grind this, which a lot of people just don't, is the fact that you have newer players usually struggle at this format, which makes Jared Betcher's finish that much more impressive and makes a couple of the other people's finishes that much more impressive. You see a lot of Hall of Famers rise to the top during these tournaments because they have more, they've seen interactions like what you're going to see in this in past games that newer players just haven't quite seen yet. Which is why at the end of day one, you saw a lot of Hall of Famers sitting there at the top. Even the ones who, you know, really have kind of fallen off. If you go through the top 64 of this tournament, you'll see a ton of Hall of Famers names up there. And that is the biggest reason why they're there. You got people who haven't played in, like, forever. You have people who haven't played in, like, forever who just jump into this and they do well. And it's kind of weird. Like, Bob showed up, Bob Maher. He went 0-3 in the draft and finished 5-3 at the end of day one. Now, the dude hasn't really played too much Magic in a long time, and there he goes, rocking a Pro Tour. You know, it's just, it's a little awkward. So, at the end of day two, at the beginning of day three, they announced Khans of Trokir.
Yeah, fucking A, they did. And this set looks sweet.
Yes, it looks good.
It looks bad for control players. I'll say that right now.
Well, we don't know that yet.
Well, we don't know that. I'm just, from the imagery and the things I've seen, I have a feeling this is just going to be straight up battled cruiser dragon Magic.
See, I can't be dragons.
My first impression was more of an Onslaught type.
Are you sure there can't be dragons? There's a dragon shadow in the art.
There is, however, if you, okay, the Vorthos is going to come out.
Here's the Vorthos.
Tarkir is the home of, Sarkhan Vol. And when Sarkhan Vol left Tarkir and found, Nicol Bolas, he left Tarkir because his dragons were gone. So I don't know if he's bringing them back, and there might be dragons.
There are hints that they're back, and that's why Sarkhan's back on the plane.
Okay, that looks fair enough. I mean, to me, it kind of, the one picture they do show, it could be like a Dragon Skull Summit. It could be an actual dragon. It could be a manland. I mean, there's a lot of things that you look in the background and go, But, you know, the hard numbers on this, there's going to be 269 cards in this set. It's set one of three. It's the Khans of Tarkir block. Pre-release date is going to be September 20th and 21st.
Oh, yeah. That's real soon, it seems, too. Am I wrong? Like, when does M15 come out?
M15 is middle of June, early July, something like that. It's quick from the M set to the next set because, you know, people don't like core sets. Launch weekend is going to be September 26th through 28th. Game day, October 18th and 19th. Magic Online pre-release will be the 3rd through the 6th, where the release date will be the 6th, with release events following from the 6th to the 22nd. Pro Tour Cons is going to be in Honolulu, Hawaii on October 10th through the 12th. And, you know, you have your basic things. And the official three-letter code is KTK. So the hashtag is MTGKTK, if you care.
This one actually makes sense, though.
Yeah, this one actually does. It's not like Journey. There was an interesting thing, though, in the interview with Mark Rosewater, where he said that there is going to be something brand new and something old that has been asked for repeatedly.
Fetchlands.
Is it?
Well,
what's everyone's guess on this?
I think, honestly, I think Fetchlands are going to be in M15. That's what I honestly believe. It's a core set. It's a easy set they could reprint them in whenever.
You know that Wizards has flat out said that the earliest they could do Fetchlands would be 2015. The year, not the set.
They say that, but that, you know, they could be trolling. They haven't been exactly honest about, you know, shit in the past when they could release shit and do shit.
Yeah, but they usually don't flat out lie to us either. I mean, I'm just being honest. Mike, what do you think it's going to be? So Ryan thinks it's going to be Fetchlands.
Well, personally, for the something old returning, I have two ideas. One is probably more realistic. The other one's more hopeful. My idea for the realistic one is horsemanship. They describe it as kind of like a tribal, like roving hordes. Like it just kind of brings that kind of like Mongol horde idea to my mind. So bringing horsemanship into a standard legal set seems interesting, but because of the flying horsemanship interaction, I don't know if it would, you know, if they'd have to errata horsemanship. But my more hopeful one is enemy colored dual lands, or man lands, sorry, not dual lands. Because they, you know, we've had Raging Ravine and Creeping Tar Pit, and those are all super cool, but like having the blue green man land or having a black green man land just seems like something they should have done a long time ago.
I actually like that. I do agree with you on the horsemanship, solely because of the Khans and the name Khans and its relation to what, you know, the actual Khans of the steppe. In Northern Asia, when they basically conquered all of China and most of the known world at that time, they were horsemen. Their bows were amazing. So I can see horsemanship being there. My hopeful one, though, is going to be...
Elder Dragons. Can they bring back Elder Dragons?
Well, no, they're all dead. Mikkel Bolas killed all of them. He won the war. That's how he got a spark. Damn it, the Vorthos. But my hopeful one is they're going to finally start toning down the power level of creatures and start toning up the power level of spells.
I think that's super wishful thinking. Just with anything Rosewater said recently, it's more like, you know, we want to bring creatures to the forefront. Because, I mean, you are like a planeswalker summoning these monsters and spells to fight for you. So the front lines of combat are going to be creatures, and spells just kind of supplement that. You know, I'm an old school player, so, you know, I miss the days of factor fiction and counterspell and whatnot. But, you know, in reality, the game has evolved to a point where, you know, a 2/2 for 1 is commonplace instead of being, you know, oh my god. You know, it has to be a legendary Hound of Isamaru, or, you know, it's got to be a rare Savannah Lions to be a 1-mana 2/1. Now that's like a common that just can't block or something. So
yeah, and that's a shame. I miss the old years. I mean, Zach Hill is still a part of the initial concept, but he had nothing to do with the actual designing. So I'm hoping with him gone, we're going to see spells. That's just me. I mean, I know it's probably wishful thinking, but I miss spells, damn it. I miss the days when a 4/4 flyer was like how you ended games.
Yeah, Air Elemental or Sarah yeah. Angel or
4/4 for 5. I got you, bitch. Yeah, the good old days. So there's that. Now, that is Khans. I'm looking forward to it. I hope it shakes Standard up. It'll be interesting to see Ravnica leave, what it actually does to Standard, because let's face facts, Ravnica is a huge part of Standard right now.
Yeah. That's the main reason you see these 2, 3, 4 color decks in Standard, is because Ravnica is still there. It gives you the dual lands, it gives you the powerful rares, you know, just being able to keep rolling with those multicolors. You know, I'm almost afraid that if there's too strong of a monocolored theme in the cons of Tarkir, that, you know, like mono black and mono blue will just rear their ugly head again. So I'm hoping they kind of balance out the colors and maybe do like a 2-color tribal theme or something.
Yeah, that would be cool. I would really enjoy that. So we're into day 3 now. We have a top 8 that consists of, in first place, coming in with just a ridiculous record. I mean, ridiculous record of 13-2-1.
Crazy.
Patrick Chapin, Hall of Famer. He has 5 Pro Tour top 8s. He has 3 GP top 8s, plus 1 Vintage World Championship top 8, and a Junior Pro Tour top 8.
Yeah.
And then all the other shit that he's done, like write books and everything else. He finishes in first place.
And with
a record of 13-2-1, as I said. And Ryan, what was he playing?
He played an awesome deck. So the rest of his team, CFB Pantheon, was on something different. We know Chapin likes to go his own route and brew his own shit. And he brew a deck, this junk mid-range deck that literally no one else at the tournament was on. I think in total the junk mid-range accounted for less than 50 matches in the entire Pro Tour.
His specific list was like his own almost.
Yeah. I mean, well, if you were playing junk mid-range, you were probably playing the exact cards he is. I mean, you're very limited in your choices. I mean, he might have had some numbers different, but the cards are the cards. He went 8-1-1 with it, and the junk mid-range actually posted a very impressive 64.75 win percent overall. So he was definitely on a sweet deck against this field. It was fucking awesome, dude.
So what did he have in it?
Okay, let's see. Chapin's junk mid-range. Let's see. Lands of Note, 4 mana confluence. And don't everyone think you need 4 mana confluence for this tournament? Yes, there was 4 mana confluence in most, you know, especially the 3-color decks. All the temples, of course, in these colors. 4 Brimaz, King of Oreskos. Parrish said it last week, if you're going to run the card, run 4. And I was like, you want 3? But yeah, 4 seemed right, and that card was fucking awesome. Chapin said it was an all-star for him. It was a game plan on its own, if they couldn't answer it. And the card did fucking work. 4 Courser Accrufix, duh. 4 Fleece Mane Lion, 2 Pelucranos, and 4 Sylvan Caryatid. The 4 Fleece Mane was a huge surprise. The card was nowhere on the weekend. And he ran 4 of them into great success. It just gave him a way to get, I mean, we're in a 3-color field. He's running 4 mana confluence, and getting a Fleece Mane Lion out, not only does it kill everyone's Sylvan Caryatids that were running around, when monstrous, it gets rid of coursers, but it also, Chapin described it beautifully as like a way to get under everyone else in the format that's playing. You know, wait until the 3, 4, 5 drops, you know, Pelucranos, the 6 drops, Elspeth. This card, and yeah, did that all weekend for him. It got in early. He played on turn 2, and it would get in at 6-9 damage.
Yeah, and it really made things hard for the players who was getting down the turn 2 Sylvan Caryatids, where yep. It was just like, oh crap, I can't block that thing. I have to take these hits. And by the time they get out their own Courser Accrufix, oh crap, that thing's indestructible and can now kill my Courser.
Yep.
Like, the card shined.
Yeah, the card was awesome, and I just thought that was a testament to Chapin's brilliance in deck building. That was a totally sick meta call. That the rest of the field just seemed to miss out on it. The Fleece Mane Lion was fucking awesome. His spells, 1 Banishing Light, that's a little surprising. I thought maybe 2. 4 Heroes Downfall, 1 Read the Bones, 4 Silence the Believers, and 3 Thoughtseize. Silence the Believers, how nuts was that card this weekend?
Oh, Silence was good.
Was insane.
Really showed off. The reason for the only 1 Banishing Light, from what I gathered watching the coverage and, you know, hearing the pros talk about their decks and what have you, was the fact that it just does not hit Stormbreath Dragon. And Green Red Elspeth was expected to show up in heavy numbers because it is one of the better decks online. So they cut those down quite a bit because they were afraid that, you know, they'd just end up with them in their hand dying to a Stormbreath.
Yeah, and Silence of the Believers. I can't stay. Okay. So in this format, what you saw a lot this weekend, what we all saw was a lot of board states that were just kind of awkward. Each player with like one or two Sylvans and one or two like coursers on their side. No other like threats really. They're just kind of playing this, you know, look at the top of the library with the courser game. And you get to this state where eventually you're just kind of staring down and both players are bubbled in. You know, no attack is going to get anybody anywhere. And it just got to a point where you would hit seven, even we saw 10 mana.
Yeah.
And when they got to that point, silence, it was like whoever cast the first Silence of the Believers 9 out of 10 times won the game.
I don't want to say 9 out of 10.
That's what it seemed like. I mean, the first one, not
if Elspeth didn't get you.
I would say the first one to hit a silence with a strive on it to clear out the other coursers and maybe something else was just, it was fucking sick. Clear out the blockers I saw to get at an Elspeth. Like,
yeah, if Elspeth didn't get you by that point, then yes, you're right. But a lot of times I saw people top deck them with an Elspeth basically about to go ultimate and it was just like too late.
Yeah, I mean, Silence the Believers was fucking awesome. I know on the Posse page we had a lot of people commenting. I think Ruben threw up at one point, a couple other people, that Silence of the Believers was just fucking doing work. Day one, it was really, really impressive as well, and several times on camera. But yeah, so the four Silence, three Thought season, finally four Elspeth Suns champions, because this is Pro Tour Elspeth, and it's the best fucking card in block. So he ran four of them. Pretty fucking sweet. Two Arbor Colossus in the board. That was good. That was a great call. I saw that. That was relevant several times, especially against opposing like Prognostic Sphinxes.
Yeah, that was its main reason really to come in most games was against Prognostic Sphinx.
He's got one Bile Blight. Okay, that's a little surprising, but this is a Chapin sideboard. You'll know in a second why. Two Boonsader, two Deicide, two Drown in Sorrow, one Feast of Dreams, two Glare of Heresy, one God's Willing, one more Read the Bones, and the fourth and final Thoughtseize. A bunch of one and twos. That's a Chapin sideboard. So.
Okay, so that was Chapin's deck, and he went up against the AC Jamie Park, who had to win his game to get in, basically.
Yeah, an old school player, man. It was
old
good
school.
To see him.
Jamie Park.
I knew, and I had no idea about this guy. I kind of looked into him a bit, and yeah, I guess he's one of the guys. I mean, he's on Pantheon, so he's obviously clearly fucking good, but.
Yeah, he has two Worlds top eights, in 1999 and in 2008. He has a total of 3 GP or Pro Tour top eights and 3 GP top eights. Like, this dude's a player. Like, he's no joke.
Yeah. I had never heard of him. He seems like he's maybe, you know, one of those like quiet voices on Pantheon that doesn't really make a big scene, just kind of works behind the scenes. And yeah, but
well,
that sucks though to play a teammate, round one of the top eight, knowing that Chapin had already commented at one point of the Pro Tour that he kind of knew that his deck had an edge in that matchup, because he got to play against that matchup so much just in testing his teammates that he kind of built like what he thought was a deck that would attack them.
Yeah, Chapin was clearly favored in this. He built that deck basically to beat Bug, which that was the deck that Park was on. And Mike, do you have the deck list pulled up for Park?
Yep, sure do.
Okay, you want to go over what he has in it and what it was?
Yeah, Jamie Park was playing the Pantheon Bug control, which was in black, blue, green, and it had kind of the lean towards an aggressive metagame. Some of its spell choices were definitely expecting more of an aggressive, which I think Chapin conversely was expecting more of the control, which is, you know, why he had the better matchup in this. You know, he was playing 26 lands. He had 4 Temple of Mystery, 4 Temple of Malady, 4 Temple of Deceit, which I think this has more been Pro Tour Temple. Every game turned into, at some point during one of your main phases, you get to scry one. He also had 2 Mana Confluence, which, saw a lot of popularity, but this deck, you know, I don't know why they didn't offer the third and fourth copies. Maybe because they were hedging against the aggressive decks, they didn't want to take the extra damage. Not real sure. But in his creatures, you know, 4 Courser Crucifix, which we've already talked about. He had 4 Prognostic Sphinx, which was kind of the breakout finisher for these control decks. And he had 2 Reaper of the Wild, which he chose over the Pelucranos. And he also had the 4 Sylvan Caryatids to fix mana, block the early game. It's pretty...
How do you feel about the fucking... Reaper of the Wilds, man.
Personally, like, Pelucranos is really good against the kind of the white-red heroic decks that saw some play in this tournament, because when you build up this huge mana advantage because, you know, you're playing 26 lands, and at certain points you could just, you know, monster summon and just take out three or four guys, where Reaper of the Wilds I think is better is in the control mirrors, because the ability to give him Hexproof to just counter their removal spells, you know, you have very few threats, so you have to protect him, which is why Prognostic Sphinx and Reaper, you know, the ability to give him Hexproof is very, very crucial. But also the fact that you could give him Death Touch to kind of like punch through the other Pelucranos, you know, is kind of he kind of played a dual role.
Yeah, it was, I saw in one match that it seemed really good, and then the few other times I saw it, I was just like, yeah, I wasn't super impressed with it. But yeah, I definitely see the case you're making for it there. I like that his sideboard is pretty transformational.
Yeah, just to run through his spells real quick, he was running one Bile Blight, you know, just kind of a hedge for the extra removal spell. One Dissolve, counter that important thing. Three Drown in Sorrow. This is where they were really hedging against the aggressive decks. Yeah. Having a sorcery that gives everything -2/-2, and when he's matched up against all these other control decks, not very good, but if you're expecting a bunch of aggro decks.
That's not necessarily terrible against Elspeth either.
That was a great call. That was a super good call on the metagame. One of the few decks that had over 300 matches was mono black aggro, and Drown in Sorrow clearly just wrecks it.
Oh yeah, it kills like, you know, 50% of the creatures in that deck outright. And then he also was running Four Heroes Downfall, which, you know, helps against the big creatures in the way, but also kills the Elspeth, which we've been talking about.
Yeah.
So you had multiple weapons in this deck against Elspeth between Heroes Downfall and the Prognostic Sphinx.
This next card, which I believe was used at one point to cast an Elspeth.
this is a very, very interesting call. The one copy of Psychic Intrusion, which is a for those
of you. Did you think this was good, Mike?
As the Miser one of copy in a block format, I think is a great call. I mean, it's a, for those of you who don't know, it's black, blue, and three for a sorcery, and target opponent reveals his or her hand. You choose a non-land card from that player's graveyard or hand. That's kind of a crucial part there. And you exile it. You may cast that card for as long as it remains exiled, and you may spend mana as though it were any color to cast it. So it lets you kind of pinpoint a super, you know, super threat or something that you didn't have the tools to deal with, but you can exile it and then use it for your own uses against them, which they might not have the answer for it.
Yeah. I know for sure that caught some people by surprise day one and two.
Oh, yeah.
I saw it on the day, get an Elspeth for during the tournament. It got an Elspeth for somebody. It got a Hero's Downfall for somebody to kill an Elspeth. It got so many crazy things. It was just like, holy shit, this card is actually really good in this format as a Miser one of. I don't know if I'd want to run four.
Yeah, in this block format, it seemed like a very kind of, I mean, you had your super aggressive decks, but in general, it was kind of a slower paced format. So having a 5-mana just kind of catch all for anything and then steal it, I think it was a great call by Channel Fireball to include that in their control decks.
Okay, sideboard?
Well, just to round up, he had two Read the Bones for card advantage, he had four Silence the Believers, which we already talked about, one Unraveled Aether, which is kind of a good catch-all removal spell for this format, and then three Kiora. This deck kind of highlighted the Kiora. It stalled against other control decks, it stalled their Prognostic Sphinxes to kind of build up to that end game where you could ultimate her and just have unlimited threats, and then against the more aggressive decks, you know, you could kind of build up your mana base quicker, draw a few extra cards, and then you have these board wipes in Drown and Sorrow and the big Reaper of the Wilds to kind of block the way. So I really like that choice for Kiora. And then to go on to the sideboard here, Ryan alluded to it earlier, how it had a little bit of a transformational sideboard. I think looking at the Channel Fireball decks, that they definitely kind of collaborated a little bit when they were between the Channel Fireball Prime and Pantheon, because you can kind of see a lot of similarities.
Well, yeah, Prime went with chose to run some of these cards' main board.
Right. It was almost like they took out the Drown in Sorrows and the kind of aggro hate main board and put in a little bit more control hate, which this bug control deck that Jamie Park and a few others from the Pantheon were playing.
It looks like they switched Drown in Sorrow with the three Ashiok.
Yeah,
That in Prime actually ran less lands.
Fewer lands, okay. Yeah. But in the sideboard, you have one Agent of Erebos, which is just a little constellation guy that exiles graveyards, just kind of a hedge for the reanimator that has been kind of plaguing Magic Online, but didn't really show up that I saw at the Pro Tour. Mm-hmm. And you have three copies of Ashiok, which in the control mirror is unreal. You just, you know, sit there and exile cards off the top. If you hit their Prognostic Sphinx, it's like, oh, look, I got a free threat to kill whatever Planeswalker you got or to pressure your life total.
It's actually very good against the green-red Elspeth as well. When you take their Stormbreaker breaths, yeah, they don't like it.
Oops, freeze storm breath. Then you had extra copies of BioBlight and Dissolve and Drown in Sorrow, you know, just to bump your totals here or there. Two Feast of Dreams, which is an interesting choice, but it kind of fits the format. I mean, it's basically your go for the throw Doomblade of the set, you know, destroy target enchanted creature or enchantment creature. Three Thoughtseize for the control match, which I think Channel Fireball Prime also had those main deck. They were running main deck Thoughtseize. And then a couple more Unravel the Aether and an extra Psychic Intrusion. So overall, Jamie Park, you know, and the Channel Fireball Pantheon team brought a very interesting control deck that, like I said, hedged against the aggressive decks, but had a huge sideboard against the other control decks.
Absolutely did. So the way this broke down was, in game one, we saw Park really jump out to an early lead behind two Sphinxes on the board at one time, and he, you know, hit a couple Silence of Believers. Pat was able to silence, targeting three different things to stall him a turn, but it just wasn't enough. So, Park goes up 1-0. Their sideboard's basically, Chapin brings in an Arbor Colossus, he brings in Reed the Boats, he brings in Boon Seder, Park brings in another Psychic Incursion, takes out a Dissolve because, I don't know. So in game two, Chapin gets off to an amazing start. He goes turn two Fleece Mainland, turn three Bermaws, okay? That's dangerous just to start with. He just, you know, basically just begins the beatdowns on, Jamie. And then Jamie later misblocks he puts a Sylvan Carotid out there to die, which he really didn't need to, and that kind of stuck him at three mana.
He was already struggling to hit the mana he needed to anyways that game.
Yeah, and he went from four mana to three when he needed a five drop, and I really think that was a misplay. And essentially that ended up costing him the game.
Yeah, he did get stuck with a Sphinx in hand.
Yeah, he never got to that Sphinx, and that was why he did get back to a fourth land like two turns later, and he probably could have, you know, stalled the board at that point. It just seemed like a strange misplay from a player with this type of pedigree. So we move to game three. It's Chapin 1, Park 1. Courser ends up playing a huge part in this game, after a Thoughtseize on turn one by Chapin to take a Kiora. Essentially that ended up winning the match. I hate to say it. I mean, Park had the same problems. He just could not get to his stuff. And when he took the Kiora, that was basically how he was going to stall Chapin out to get to his mana. And it never happened.
Or even possibly he could have planned to use that to hit extra land drops, you know, the plus or the minus one to draw a card and play an extra land. That can speed you up quite a bit.
Yeah, and Chapin really got a little aggro on this one too, and that was
that the game? Was game three the one that they both kept one landers?
Yes.
Okay. And then Chapin proceeded to go turn two, rip
the you're thinking of an absolutely different match. I think you're thinking of the one that happened in the semis.
Yeah, it might have been.
Yeah. So it went 2-1. That was that quarterfinal. Pat Chapin moves on. Okay, so the number 13 player in the world versus the number 14 player in the world. We have Josh Utter Layton, the reigning player of the year, with career numbers of, this was his fifth Pro Tour top eight. He has 7 GP top eights. 7!
Just keep in mind, this guy's only been a pro for like 7 years. He's still 3 years out of the Hall of Fame talk.
To have
that many Pro Tour top eights, like we're talking like Kai Finkel numbers at this point, if he keeps on this kind of tear that he's been on.
Yeah, it's kind of nutty. I mean, it just, the consistency of his play is unreal. But he was on the prime bug control list. Ryan, do you want to go over that real fast for me?
Bug Control by Raptor. Let's see. He's only running one mana confluence, 24 lands. Sadly, I think that's wrong. Especially the mana problems he fucking had all day. Let's see. The 24 lands, the temples, of course, the mana confluence. 4 Coursers, 4 Prognostic Sphinx, and 4 Sylvan Caryatids. Pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
2 Bioblight, 1 Dissolve, 4 Heroes Downfall, 3 Silence the Believers, 4 Thoughtseize, 2 Unravel the Aether, which was sweet, by the way.
Yes.
4 Ashiok and 4 Kiora.
Ooh, it's a nice list, man.
Yeah, I mean, again, it comes down to, I think he got mana fucked way too much. Let's see, sideboard. This is definitely a Raptor sideboard. 1 Bioblight, 1 Dark Betrayal, 1 Dissolve, the 3 Drowned in Sorrows, 1 Erebos, 2 Feast of Dreams. Card is really good. 3 Gainsay, 1 Psychic Intrusion, 1 Read the Bones, and 1 more Silence the Believers.
Mm. Okay. I mean, there's slight differences between the two lists. The lands is, you know, that's two big ones there. And, but, you know, both lists were good lists on the weekend. But he gets to go up against Stanislav Sivka, Mr. Eggs himself.
Yeah. I mean, this is a favorable matchup for him too, I must say. I didn't see how there was.
I thought Sivka was favored in this. Oh. He was favored game one. Game two and three was kind of a coin flip, but he was clearly favored game one because, Raptor had to do a lot of sideboarding to, fix this deck. Stanislav Sivka, this was his second Pro Tour top eight. He has three GP top eights. He finished the day 12-3-1. He was on red, white, heroic. What was in this was really the only aggro deck in the format as far as the top eight goes. And, Mike, what was in Sivka's deck?
Well, Sivka decided to take as far away a step as he could from eggs and just play a few draft decks that he had and just kind of jammed them together. No, he was playing red, white, heroic. Lands of Note, he had four Temple of Triumph, four Mana Confluence, just to make sure he could hit those double colors on the early turns. Creatures, you have four Acroan Crusader, four Favorite Hoplite, one Hero of Iroas, three Mogus's Warhound, which I think is probably kind of the crucial pick of the deck. Having that early 2-2 that has to attack each turn or could turn into a heroic trigger enabler, you know, I think that card really helped this deck. And then you have the four Phalanx Leaders to pump your team and four Satyr Hoplites. Literally, this looks like kind of draft offshoots that he picked up off tables at the end of FNM and just gives you kind of the Theros block idea of limited and that it has this huge cohesive deck for this red white aggro deck. I think, you know, just looking at this in the entire list, he has what, 13 rares in the entire list. Like, this is proof that you can build a good deck without money.
Yeah, and it's like, what, 12 one drops? It's absurd.
Look out for going forward. Even in standard right now, there's a pretty sick red-white heroic deck that Saito posted that some people have been working on and running. It's very similar to this. Sivka said he wanted to be as proactive as possible in this tournament, and I think this was the most proactive you could be.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You basically told your opponent, have an answer. If you don't, you're dead. Like, have an answer. And putting people on their heels sometimes just works.
And the thing looking forward is every set in the next block that's printed, anything that says target creature you control is just going to make this deck that much better.
Yeah.
Yeah, if it's better than some of the ones we have, the real all-star of this deck was the, one drop or the one white target multiple different things.
Yeah, launch the fleet. Yeah, that was. Kind of the poster child for this deck, having the strive cost to just target multiple things, pump your entire team, make more guys, like for three or four mana, what more can you ask for?
Oh, and you're targeting guys that make, not only are you targeting things that get 1-1 counters, but you're targeting things like a Crone Crusader, which puts 2-1-1s out, basically, like, just crazy.
Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous. It's like, oh, I'm gonna, you know, pick this one, pick my Phalanx Leader, and it's like, oh, now I have 2/2s, ha, fuck you. It's just not fair. When he gets going, it can be crazy. Did you go over the sideboard?
No, not yet. To round out the spells, he had the limited all-stars, 4x coordinate assault, 4 dragon mantle, 4 god's willing, and 4 ordeal of perforos, which kind of doubles as the only removal in this deck, which is kind of interesting that he didn't run a lightning strike or anything like that. So you have god's willing to get around the creatures and ordeal of perforos to kind of shoot them out of the way after you get your third counter.
Right.
His sideboard kind of leaned more towards to beat the control decks. He had 2 brimaz, 2 chain to the rocks, which is just premium removal in this deck, 2 fall of the hammer, pretty good removal, 4 Laguna Band Trailblazer to, I don't know if this was for the aggro decks or what, but the 1-mana 0-4 with Heroic. Mm-hmm. The 4th copy of the Mogus's Warhound, and then 4 Ordeal of Helion.
A little bit of life gain.
Yeah, nothing wrong, especially when it's pumping your creatures, like, you know, the whole
argument. He's very well situated. I mean, he's got, if you look at this board, you can make an argument for bringing in 10 cards in the aggro matchup.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he's very, very suited for that matchup, and I think he, you know, he made a concession to control, and
I disagree completely. Like, cards like Ashiok and Kiora, they're just not good against this deck. This deck's going to kill you before really get going with those.
The control decks that we have in this block format aren't, like, things that these super fast creature heavy aggro decks have to worry about. They're not playing things like Verdict and shit. They're trying to one for one you.
You can't play Verdict. I mean, he was playing for the
tournament. Exactly. That's what I'm saying. The control decks in this block don't play things like Verdict. So these decks can kind of hedge against the not having to bring in much against the control matchup and can hedge against aggro more. There's just not a control deck that's really well suited in this format to handle a bunch of dudes getting spewed on the board and then pumped one way or another. They're trying to one, the control decks in this block are trying to one for one you and then get to a threat.
Yeah, the
control decks. Get to a point where they could be stable enough to play either a Kiora and keep your threat down or, you know,
an so out. How is he conceding his match to control if it's better against control?
And I'm saying in his sideboard, he's just got tons of stuff that you could argue, like definitely against aggro, I see 10 cards right away that could be brought in.
Right.
I just really see anything he brings in against control.
There's very little that he brings in against control, to be honest.
I think Brimaz.
It's Brimaz. That's what you bring in against control. It's like, I'm going to bring in some Brimaz. That's really
but awesome. Other than that, I don't think I think this aggro deck and some of the mono black aggro deck we saw at this tournament were pretty well suited for the control decks they were going to run into and could afford to hedge against other aggro decks the way he did.
Right, and in this format, the problem with the control versus aggro is the control deck isn't your traditional like board wipe, card advantage control deck. It's more of like the kind of Jun mid-range where you're one for one-ing and just running them out of threats and then you drop your big threat. So yeah. I think the aggro decks are really well positioned in this format.
Yeah. It's very hard to get your footing against this, as Angelo would say.
Yeah, so game one, Sifka Leighton, 13 versus 14. Raptor couldn't have asked for a better start. He goes turn two Carotid, turn three Courser. He got a couple decent blockers there, but then he failed to see lands on the top of his deck. He does thought seize to take Sifka's Phalanx Leader over God's Willing and, you know, a couple other things. He has a really good start, but the issues with the mana. Sifka, he actually could have won the game.
I don't want to cut you off, but I want to say that I thought that moment you just mentioned where Raptor thought seized and Sifka didn't respond by casting a God's Willing on one of his dudes was... I thought that was brilliant play.
I really thought it was too myself. I thought Raptor was going to take the God's Willing.
Yeah, I think most players in that situation would have popped off the God's Willing, cause he had, Utter Leighton had more mana than, you know, just what he cast the Thoughtseize with that he could have followed up with some sort of removal.
Yeah.
That was super disciplined in a situation where probably 90 some odd percent of players would have thrown that out there.
I figured he was going to be real honest. I thought for sure he was going to. When he took the Phalanx Leader, I was like, wow, that was brilliant. Because, like, I thought he was just going to take God's Willing away from him. And, you know, then it's like, okay, now I have room to actually start using my removal. And it just, he didn't. I know the leader is very strong in that deck. I thought that was weird. But both of these players are far better than I am. So I'm going to say it was the right play.
I mean, Raptor needed a land drop and failed the find for four turns.
And that's just the variance of Magic sometimes. You miss your lands and you
lose. It was really painful, and I like how he kept his composure. Marshall, you know, made the comment that this guy is like, must have ice running through his veins because he's just...
Oh yeah, he didn't even care come the beginning of game two. It was like, yeah, whatever.
I'd have been so on tilt going into game two that I don't think I'd have played optimally. He... Just wow.
That's why you talk on a podcast and he wins money at a Pro Tour.
This guy's played so many games of Magic.
It was impressive.
So obviously Sifka wins this. He actually could have wanted a turn earlier and he chose not to attack. He didn't want to be overly aggressive in case Raptor did have an answer to one of his creatures. He waited a turn knowing perfectly next turn I have this game no matter what. I'll just wait a turn. Smart play on him. He brought in his Brimazes, of course, Sifka did, and what Raptor did was he brought in all three of his Drowning Sorrows, took out his Kiora, took out his Ashiok, put in another Bow Blight, and then the matchup changes. Sifka's no longer favored at this point. So game two starts out, Sifka mulligans one time in game two. An early Drowning Sorrow really reset the board for him. And he never really was able to rebound at all. And Raptors control deck got to the point where it's like, okay, now I can play control. And to be honest, like, he didn't even let him get to that point. He was like, yeah, let's go to the third game. It was like, that's a big thing I can't get through. That's a big thing I can't get through. Let's just move to the next game. And they did. And so it's 1-1. We're going into game three. And you know what? Sometimes you just get the cards off the top of your deck that you need every single time. And Ryan, I know you watched this, and am I imagining it, or did it just seem like Raptor just went removal, 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 you're dead?
Pretty much.
that's how that game went down, so.
Yeah, an answer for everything. The second game, I thought it was a good game. Game one went a really long time in spite of Sivka having the edge and taking it out. And, game two, I think, was much shorter than that. So.
Yeah. And game three was extremely, so, that's how that went down. So we know one of our semis right now. It's Patrick Chapin versus Josh Utter-Layton, both winning 2-1. So then we have the number two player in the world.
The Duke.
Reed Duke, who, just by top aiding this, through results of other matches, he will be the number one player in the world by the time you hear this podcast. Congratulations to Reed Duke on that. This strange...
Yeah, someone deserves it, and overthrowing what we learned when we had Harry on, a guy that's a scumbag. So way to overthrow Dazani and his scumbaggery, Reed Duke. We need a nice guy at the top spot.
So Reed shows up into the top eight with a 12-3-1 record. He has 10 Grand Prix top eights. However, this was his first Pro Tour top eight. So, like, this is the best player in the world to never make a Pro Tour top eight. Now he has that. So, I mean.
And he was very, very close to being the best player in the world to never make the top eight still.
Very close.
Very, very close.
He did come in as the two seed. His breakers were excellent. But, I mean, there was a couple rounds early on towards the end of day two where he could have lost.
I think he won his last two rounds or something like that. And then was able to, or his last three, I think he went 2-0-1. I think he was able to draw. I think he got into a position where he could draw. And so,
Absolutely. So, Ryan, what deck was Reed on? Which version of, this bug control?
Bug control and 2-mana confluence, all the temples, 6 swamps, 1 island, 5 forests. Let's see, 14 creatures, 4 courser, 1 Pelucranos, 4 Prognostic Sphinx, 1 Reaper, and 4 Sylvan Caryatids, cause duh. 17 other spells in a very not Reed Duke fashion. We have 1 Bile Blight, 1 Dissolve, 3 Drowned in Sorrow, 4 Heroes Downfall, 1 Psychic Intrusion, 2 Read the Bones, 4 Silence the Believers, 1 Unravel the Aether. When I saw this Reed Duke's list, I was so surprised they were able to convince him to play this. he's one of those guys that generally runs a deck that's all 3 and 4 ofs. He's got a game plan and knows exactly what he wants to do and how to execute it. He's not one of those guys you ever see running just ones or twos of. So yeah, this deck was very different for him. Rounds out his spells with 3 Kioras.
Yeah, this is a version of the Pantheon, the Channel Fireball Pantheon, very similar to Jamie Park. The big difference is the 1 Pelucranos and 1 of the Reaper, instead of the 2 Reapers. So he chose to go with the 1 Pelucranos.
I can see, that's hedging your bets both ways. Yeah.
Right.
And that's no surprise that Duke's running a Reaper. He has commented on that card before. So.
Yes, he has. So he gets to play against our 7 seed.
You want me to hit a sideboard right quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. 3 Ashiok in the board, 1 Bile Blight, 2 Dissolve, 1 Drowned, 2 Feast of Dreams, 1 Psychic Intrusion, another one there, 3 Thoughtseize, all on the board, 2 Unravel the Aether.
That's basically the Pantheon sideboard that, we went over earlier. So he gets to go up against Yuki Ichikawa. Yuki Ichikawa is his third Pro Tour ever. He's middling success, but he's a growing player. He has no GP top eights. This is his first Pro Tour top eight. The impressive part about Yuki is you didn't hear me say his name when I went over the top 20 for day one, because he started the day 2-3 and then ends up with a record of 12-3-1 at the end of day two.
That's an unbelievable run at a pro tour.
Yeah, that's just saying, you know what? Fuck it. I can't lose, and doing it.
That's like another guy in our top eight that we'll go over that started the day 2-2.
Yep, absolutely. We'll go over him shortly here. And what list was Ichikawa on there, Mike?
Well, as Angelo and I discussed a little bit before the podcast, this is Green Red Elspeth.
It's not Red Green Elspeth. We corrected Wizards.
Yeah, looking at the list, this is a green ramp mid-range strategy.
I do want to say real quick, Mike, this deck here was the most played deck at the Pro Tour.
Yeah, you have results on that?
It had 392 matches, which was far and away the most matches, and just a win percentage of 50.68, which doesn't sound too exciting, but with being the most played deck in the room, 50% is about, you know, as good as you can ask for, I guess.
Yeah, it's pretty good when you actually think about how many were there, how many games were played with it, and the fact that you probably have a bunch of people who, you know, aren't real pro tour players, you know.
I was really surprised to see this deck in the numbers it was simply because of its block online performance prior to the PT. It's got the highest online winning percentage in block. Mm-hmm. I just figured that would – I thought it would just see so much hate that it just wouldn't be there. I assumed that this and Black Aggro would not be in the force they were simply because of everyone knew about them already. I mean, they were kind of the top decks on the radar going into this as far as block was concerned.
Yeah, that and like Mike said earlier, the Reanimator deck in recent weeks has just been causing havoc.
Yeah, which we didn't really
see it very much of at all, but I mean, that's like the big one the last couple weeks. Yeah, Green Red is kind of.
Reanimator did, it had under 200 matches played, but it did have a 50% win, okay. Win as well, so.
Sounds right. So what is in this Green Red deck that we're talking about with Elspeth?
Well, lands of note, you have 3 mana confluence, and then on the temples, instead of running the full 12, they opted out of the red white ones because this deck is Green Red Elspeth, not red green. So it's, the 4 Temple of Abandon, 4 Temple of Plenty. You have your 8 green temples. As far as creatures go, they had the obligatory Courser of Kruphix, Sylvan Caryatid. They have Voyaging Satyr to ramp their mana. They have Stormbreath Dragon, probably one of the bigger air threats in the format. 1 Pelucranos and 4 Polis Crusher, the little played Cyclops from Eros.
That card was so good this weekend. It was so good.
Well, you can't block with your Courser, and when I monstrous, your Courser's dead.
And it died. Dodges so much of the relevant removal.
Especially in this mirror match. Like in the green-red Elspeth mirror, their only removal is Banishing Light and Chained to the Rocks, which you run 4 copies of each. Polis Crusher says no. I'm alright, thanks though.
Mm-hmm.
And then to round out the list, there are 2 Ajani Mentor of Heroes to pump up all your guys, 4 Elspeth, which is the deck's namesake, and 1 Xenaghost the Reveler to kind of help ramp mana, put creatures out there.
And what's this sideboard look like?
Your sideboard has 2 Hammer of Purphoros, 4 Hunt the Hunter. This deck was ready for the other Courser of Kruphix and whatnot. 4 Magma Spray, the new reprint.
What is that a call? I gotta completely agree with you on Hunt the Hunter. That is fucking awesome.
Like, this deck saw Courser Kruphix is going to be a thing. You know, I want to be able to just fight him and get him off the board and keep rolling.
Yep. Yeah.
And then, to round it off, they had 2 Purphoros, God of the Forge, which I think, if I scan through real quick, is the only god in the top 8 anywhere in any of the lists.
The Purphoros?
Yes.
I do want to say I think that's a wrong call. I think the Xenaghost,
Well, it's the reasoning that it's brought in. It's brought in against control decks, so when you play this and then follow that with an Elspeth, every time you activate Elspeth, you're throwing 6 at their face.
I understand that.
That's the only reason it's in there. They only bring it in against the big control decks.
Yeah, but you know what? I think Xenagod is also pretty damn good against control because you don't have to play as many threats, and the ones you do are all bigger threats because of his ability when they attack.
Fair. I mean, so, I'll give you that. I just don't know what I'd take out of the main board to put it in.
Overall, synergy-wise, I thought the Xenagod gave a little bit better synergy simply because there's so many fatties in here. I mean, to hit with an 8-8 Storm Breath instead of a 4-4, you know, a 14-14 Storm Breath is just insane when it's monstrous. There's just so many things, like the Pelucranos. I don't know, man. Polis Crusher. I just thought Zinagod would have been just absolutely backbreaking in here, but yeah. I like his 3 Zinagosts the Revelers in the board, though. That card's really good.
Yeah, that kind of the round out. Probably in the control matchups, you take out your Johnny and add in more Zinagosts just for more continuous threats instead of making your threats bigger.
Yeah, absolutely correct. That was better that way.
Against control, I did see that where the Zinagos just the 2/2 with haste was just fucking huge.
Yep. So he's playing against Reed Duke. I mean, we're all just expecting Reed to just punish this guy. Why? Because he's Reed Duke. And for no other reason, he's Reed Duke. Unfortunately, game one, Reed Duke mauls to 6. Ichi gets an Elspeth and an Ajani out. Duke comes back, kills an Elspeth, but then Ichi immediately follows it with a second one. And the umpteenth soldiers plus the two Ajani's, I'm sorry, he did end up drawing a second one because he figured, let's negative this one so I can get, you know, my next planeswalker because I have another Ajani in hand and now I will increase this soldier and swing for lethal. And it's just like, okay, that's
game. Oh, he ultimated?
No, he did not ultimate. He chose not to. He basically killed his own Ajani by playing a second one, but he wanted to use both abilities.
Okay, he wanted the plus one advice.
Yeah, he had the ability at 1.2 ultimate it and chose not to. Duke, game two, Ichi brings in, you know, I believe he brought in the Purphoros. This meant really nothing. I did not hear what Duke brought in. I have no clue on the sideboard that Duke had. It really didn't matter because Duke mulligans again. Ichi kept his hand, but it had no real gas. It was just lands, Karatid, and Satyr. His first draw, though, he gets a Zinagos, then a Pelucranos, and then an Ajani, and then a Storm Breath. That was his first few draws off the top of his deck, which is absurd, right?
He's run out of removal eventually, and actually, to go what you said on Reed Dukes, I'm looking at his sideboard, and I'm just not really seeing anything.
I'm not 100% sure what you do bring in.
Unravel the Aether, maybe?
You probably bring in the Thoughtseize to get rid of some of the Planeswalkers, but I just don't know.
Maybe Drowning Star to kind of try and hinder his early mana, like to cut out the Reveler, the Voyaging Satyr. Yeah, just to cut him out.
I just don't know if that's worth a whole card slot to kill Voyaging
Satyr. I was going
to
say, if you're bringing that in for Satyr, that's, you're
not, in trouble.
Right, yeah.
I'm just looking at his sideboard, I don't think it's not well suited for this matchup at all.
Right, I think the only, like, auto include is Ashiok just to hope to hit some of those big threats.
Yeah. He probably brought in a couple Thoughtseize, probably brought in a couple Ashiok. I do believe he brought in the Thoughtseize because Ichi just has so many Planeswalkers.
And 4 and 5 cost threats, so like you can catch him early.
Yeah, you can catch him, you know, on turn 3 even. That's when you're going to be casting it. But eventually Ichi does swing for lethal. Reed gets to cast the hero's downfall, but it means nothing. It just extends it another turn. He draws his next card and goes, nope. Extends the hand. Ichi moves on. Ichikawa. Yuki Ichikawa, 2-0 over Reed Duke. Like, that is the shocking result of day 3. Hands down. Like, I never saw it.
It was heartbreaking, dude. That was tough to watch, man. I was cheering so hard for Reed. To get bad beats, it was over so fast that, like,
I don't even know if it's really
helped feel bad, man, to finally crack the Pro Tour top 8 and to lose in 2 like that.
I think, didn't the same thing happen to Jerry Thompson when he finally cracked the top 8?
Yeah, pretty much. He got bounced fast. That was a strange top 8, though, because there were so many first-timers there. You had Melissa DeTora. You had just so many people who it was the first one, and yeah, it was a weird top 8, actually.
The one Martel won.
Yes, Tom Martel won that one. So, our last game of the quarterfinals. We have Andrea Mengucci.
Yeah, the Italian Stallion, man, made it to the top 8.
Yes, this is our King of the Hill all weekend. Like, he won back the King of the Hill on day 2. Like, the dude just was not fucking around. He started 11-1 with his only loss was Chapin at the end of day 1. Like, that's a pretty good goddamn start.
Yeah, having your only... Oh, go ahead, Ryan.
Yeah, pretty sweet. What were you going to say, Mike?
I was going to say having your only loss be the number 1 seed at the end of the day. You know, I'll take it.
Feeling pretty good about yourself.
Yeah, that's clearly solid.
This deck is another red-green Elspeth, slightly different. So he, where Ichi was, 4 forests, 3 mana confluence, 8 mountains, he, Mengucci is just 7 forest, 5 mountain, no mana confluence. He just cut the mana confluence, added the 3 forests, and cut down on mountains, which, to be fair, was, it's probably the right move. Your early drops here really hinge on green, especially Courser. That's, this mana base, I would probably say is the one you want to look into if you're, you know, playing block or looking into red-green going forward.
If you're looking into standard going forward, I think you want to really look at this mana base.
He's also running all 12 temples, which the other green-red deck was not.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, yeah, I didn't even notice that. He's running Temple of Abandon, Plenty, and Triumph. So he's got that. So that explains why he cut down on mountains also. So whereas Ichi ran one plains and none of the temples, he cut one plains and added 4 Temple of Triumph, so, and cut 3 mountains. So let's see, 19 creatures, 4 Courser Acruphix, duh, 4 Polis Crusher, 4 Storm Breath Dragon, the 4 Caryatid, and 3 Voyaging Satyrs. Yeah, pretty standard for this deck here. It's what we've been seeing online. 10 other spells. His spell package is slightly different.
Yes, it is.
It adds his creatures too. He has opted not to run Pelucranos. And one less Voyaging Satyr. Which, to be fair, I thought this deck was a little better. I don't know, Pelucranos just, were you impressed with that once this weekend?
Early on in day one I was a couple times, but for the most part, no.
Yeah, it's never, no, it got whacked every time it hit the board.
I failed to mention earlier, this is Mengucci's first Pro Tour top 8 and he has 0 GP top 8s.
Amazing. He is, however, from what I understand, sort of a very well respected player in Italy, and they said he's like considered a phenom there.
I believe it. He's only like, what, 20 years old?
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know how big the Italian Magic scene is or whatever, but, I mean, it's obviously not like here in the U.S., but he is considered a phenom in his country at this game. We'll probably be seeing him popping up at GPs now, so he's got a little cash to travel around and make these things. It's hard to get to GPs from Italy, man. let's see. His spells, he's got 2 Banishing Light, 3 Destructive Revelry. That card was nuts this weekend.
Yes, it was.
God, was that card good. What a great meta call, man. I hadn't seen that main board online. I think that was kind of his own little spin from testing, and fuck, dude, every time he cast that, I was wowed.
Yeah, it's just like, let's kill your Courser Acruphix, set you back on your mana drops, and you can eat 2.
And it's 2 damage, which I found very relevant, along with 4 Lightning Strikes and 1 Magma Jet, so huge difference over the, where Ichi's trying to hit you with 4 Banishing Light and 4 Chain to the Rocks and more Planeswalkers.
Yeah.
He's opted just, and it was the right call. Lightning, a top deck Lightning Strike won him a game day one.
I saw actually a Destructive Revelry win him a game.
Yeah, the little, we all know in these, man, that little incremental damage you can get in, especially in a format full of mana confluence. When they're mana confluencing themselves all day, that Lightning Strike certainly is, you know, it starts to look a lot better.
Destructive Revelry impressed me throughout the day because it was basically Terminate with a shock staple to it for free.
Right?
Like,
yeah.
To kill a creature and deal 2 damage to your opponent.
Kill your Courser and take 2.
Lot of times it was a Stone Rain attached too because, you know, it's like, oh, that's my next land drop right there on top. And it's like, oh, God damn. I don't get to get it.
Really fucking sweet. The one Magma Jet, I guess, you know, he just threw that in there for giggles, I guess.
Well, it's almost like a 5th Lightning Strike with Scry instead of the 3rd damage. Like, it helps you kind of set up your draws and kind of kills the smaller creatures, or just gives you extra reach. I really like it.
Yeah, I liked his spell package a lot more. It just, I mean, first of all, you're playing the biggest creatures in the format. Do you really need removal for their creatures? Like, Chained to the Rocks? I mean, do you really, are your dudes not already gonna kill theirs in combat? You know what I mean?
Also, he's also hedging for the mirror because his Destructive Revelries negate all of the other green red Elspeth X removal plus deal damage. Like,
at instant speed to get it to the rocks at instant speed and bring a dude back. That was fucking huge. Banish, I mean, yeah, the instant speed on that I think is really fucking good. So his Planeswalkers, 4 Elspeths, obviously the namesake of the deck, and 3 Xenagos, which I thought was a better call again over the Ajani's and the 1 Xenagos. I like the 3 Xenagos. That card was very good this weekend.
Yeah, he was anticipating more of a control matchup, and yeah, worked out perfectly for him. Like, I just want the Xenagos. I don't need the Ajani's. I'll take Destructive Revelry over that.
Yeah, watching the Satyr tokens really do snowball in this format that really can't, like, you know, they can only one for one you so long with removal. He ultimated this.
Yes, he did, and hit hard.
So he hit, let's see, his sideboard, 3 Anger of the Gods, 2 Arbor Colossus, 1 Destructive Revelry, 2 Glare of Heresy, 2 Hammer of Perforos, 4 Magma Spray, and the 4 Synagos. So when we saw him ultimate, did he hit both his Arbor Colossus?
Dude, he hit 7 playables.
Yeah, right. It was ridiculous.
He didn't whiff at all. Everything went into play. He said he's never done that.
Well, he said that he had ultimated him twice, I think, earlier in the day, off camera or something.
Yeah, but he didn't hit that well. That was basically.
He said he had hit like 2 one time and like 3 or something another. But yeah, dude, fucking that was sick, dude. That was so awesome. And his +1 ability, what, you know, I didn't think would be one we'd see a bunch, but that was relevant more than one time.
I'm gonna butt in real quick on you guys. Sorry about that, but I'm surprised. Right. Like looking at that, you know, this is hindsight is 2020. The whole thing. I'm surprised nobody played a green, red, blue mid range and main deck Anger of the Gods. Like to have basically the threats of this green, red Elspeth deck plus Kiora and Xenagos, and then just have the best board wipe in the format. Like it kind of blew my mind that nobody hit that.
Yeah. Well, I already said earlier I was really, really disappointed with the lack of innovation this weekend. Nobody came with anything that hasn't been being played online.
Yeah, but it wasn't like it was the online meta either. It was completely different than the online meta.
There was no gray merchants anywhere, which that is a big block player online.
I want to say Channel Fireball pretty much innovated with the bug list. I haven't seen that online.
Yeah, I haven't seen that at all online. You didn't see any of the straight mono reds.
I've seen too much
of the straight mono white.
And obviously players were on bug control because that was only one of 4 decks that had over 300 matches on the weekend.
But you got to consider the team that ran it. You had the Pantheon, you had both Channel Fireball teams on it where that's a large part of the field.
It had a 60% win percent for a reason.
Well, it's crazy to think, like now that I'm sitting here thinking about it, both the Channel Fireball teams is probably pretty close to 10% of the field because they have what, probably 10 to 12 players per team?
Well, Pantheon put 3 in the top 8.
Right.
3. There was 4 CFB in the top 8 if you count Raptor, who's not on Pantheon, but.
Right, but he's on the other Channel Fireball team.
Yeah, 4. 4 in the top 8. That's crazy. I wonder if SCG is regretting what they did now.
I forget who said it, but one of you guys said in the last couple casts that it's time for Channel Fireball to come back, and they did it very, very strongly in this
round. I think that was Angelo was like, they're gonna be on a fucking tear. Yeah.
Sometimes I can read the tea leaves, man.
The gods, though, I like that call there. Very good. Yeah, I really liked this deck, man. This deck is a lot of fun to watch.
Just the fact that Anger is the only card in the format to kill Sylvan Caryatid. I mean, that's a huge deal when every deck is running it.
It really is right now. It really is a big deal right now.
So look forward to Standard. I would pick up your Anger of the Gods now. It's going to be big.
Well, we've been saying pick up your Angers for fucking weeks now.
Yeah, if they don't got them by now, they're doing it wrong.
And you need them for Modern anyway, so.
Right. That was Andreas Mangucci's list. And then we have, you know, a little known guy named Nem Samwook, who comes in 12-3-1, starts the day 2-2, finishes day 1 at 5-3. So basically
Is he really a little known guy?
He is very little known. This is the first ever South Korean to top 8 a Pro Tour. Now that South Koreans are playing Magic, folks, we're done.
He is the current
leader, however, on MTGO for the constructed player of the year race.
Yeah,
earlier in the day, he had already beat Chapin.
He was the only one to beat Chapin in the Swiss with block.
Yes.
I think Chapin's deck went unbeaten in the Swiss portion until Nam Sung-wook beat him. Was one loss, but yeah, I mean, he has won a GP.
I was just getting to that, Ryan. You're cutting me off, man. he does have 2 GP top 8s, and this is his first Pro Tour top 8. In GP Melbourne, he won with Mono Black, and then he followed that up 2 weeks later with another top 8 in Beijing. So he has been moving up on the Asian side, but I mean, as far as most people in the Magic world knew, like, they didn't know the guy, but if you do play online, NSW, this is him. And well, if you play online, you know who this guy is.
Let's be fair, MTG Mint Card is an Asian super team. And
he's I know. I've got bounced out of GPs by him. I know. You don't have to remind me every time one of these.
MTG Mint Card is no joke, dude.
Yeah.
I think that and the French are the two groups that'll definitely be challenging CFE the most in coming Pro Tours.
Fair enough. But he came in with something completely different. He was playing Junk Constellation. And Mike, what's this deck look like, man?
I love this deck. In Standard, I've been playing a version of this deck, but without the white, just straight black-green. But his lands of note, he has 2 mana confluence, the full 12 temples, 5 forests, 3 swamp, 2 plains. Pretty spread mana-based. His creatures, he has 4 Sylvan Caryatid, 4 Course of Crucifix, which you expect. But then, this is where it goes off the deep end. 4 Brain Maggot, one of my favorite cards out of Journey into Nyx. 4 Eidolon of Blossoms, another good one. And 3 Herald of Torment. This card has an engine, and it's ready to roll. Like,
yeah, it's called Eidolon of Blossoms. I'll draw.
Whew. Like,
I do want to say this is not the sweetest Eidolon deck we did see in the tournament. I want to say day 1 or 2, they did show an Infinite Blossoms running the 4 Eidolon of Blossoms, Thassa's Ire, Market Festival, and Shrine to Nyx.
And that's being cute where this was more
this
effective.
Yeah, like, that one was going for the infinite mana combo, dumping some huge things.
Like, this is the Blossoms deck that takes the frills and pigtails, chops them off, and just gets down to work.
Yeah, you don't need that. I'm like, first of all, I couldn't figure that out because I'm like, what are you going to do with infinite mana in this format? What, is there there's not an X spell or anything in block, I don't believe.
I was going to say you have Pelucranos. That's the only X's I can think of, other than
just a Hydra.
I couldn't figure out why he was trying to get infinite mana in block. I just didn't understand.
I guess Mistcutter Hydra?
Huh?
Mistcutter Hydra. That's kind of an X spell.
Yeah, that is an X spell. I mean, I guess.
That's kind of stretching.
So continue on with the deck, man.
All right, the spells in this Junk Constellation deck. I mean, if you're playing black, 4 Thoughtseize, you know, if you're not playing control, that's kind of the way to go. 4 Heroes Downfall, 2 Silence the Believers, which I still think is probably the breakout card of this tournament. Like, 4 mana instant removal seems kind of iffy, but when you can pay an extra 3 and just kill another guy, unreal. It's like super kicker. And then 4 Banishing Light to kind of add to the Blossoms theme, plus have just kind of unconditional removal. And then finally, 3 Elspeth, Sun's Champion, just to give you that top end.
Okay. Sideboard?
Sideboard, 1 Agent Verbose, again, kind of the concession to the Graveyard Reanimator decks. 2 Dark Betrayal, 1 Deicide, 2 Feast of Dreams, 4 Fleece Main Lion, 1 Glare of Heresy to get rid of those other Elspeths, 3 Reaper of the Wilds, and then the third copy of Silence of the Believers in the sideboard.
Okay. Now, he's playing against Andreas Mengucci, who I'm not going to say right now, I was rooting for this kid. I mean, I wanted this kid to take this fucker down. When you're sitting here watching this and you see this pairing, you go, Mengucci already lost to him in round 14. This is not a great matchup for Mengucci.
Yeah, that late in the day, like, to have a loss to somebody, you pretty much already know the matchup. So.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. So, in game 1, Mengucci does maul to 6. He keeps a hand of Voyaging Satyr, Elspeth, and 4 lands, which, that's hoping to get there.
Yeah.
He proceeded to draw lands, and he did get 1 more, Elspeth. However, that was taken by a Thoughtseize.
With Sung Wook's deck having 8 main deck hand denial cards, like, I don't know if I would keep that deck. I mean, in the top 8, you know your opponent's deck list. Like, that just seems like a super sketchy hand.
Yeah, in the top 8, you know his deck list, and you played him 2 rounds ago.
Right.
So it's like, what are you doing? But, you know, hey, Mengucci does end up getting down the Stormbreath.
Cut him some slack.
Right. He does end up getting down a Stormbreath and winning with it. So Mengucci takes game 1. Nam goes and sides in his Fleece Mains. He sides in a total of 9 cards. Again, I did not get to hear what Mengucci did with his sideboard, but 9 cards Nam brought in.
I thought was a very weird. I didn't think it was suited for this matchup.
I really didn't either. I thought he was just dead.
I guess if you can, what I was thinking he brought that in was for like the miracle off chance that he can monstrous it and just block his big fatties all day.
Yeah, block him forever. That was basically the reasoning. behind it. It's like, I can block everything he has except Storm Breath forever.
Yeah, and then he probably sides out some of the Banishing Lights for, like, just Fleece Mains, just to, like, because Banishing Light basically doesn't hit the card he needs to hit, so yep. He brings in the extra Silence and then just more Threads. That's probably my guess.
Yeah, that's probably about right. So game two starts. Yeah, he ends up, Nam pretty much just runs this over. He gets an Elspeth down. He ends up killing a Storm Breath with it. Revelry, Nam follows with an Elspeth and just rides it. Pretty much just rides it. And he's just like, okay, yeah, I'm going to win this. So it's 1-1. Game three, Mengucci mauls to 6 again. Well, that was good for him in game one.
Nemsung, I don't know if it's ever good for you.
Yeah, Nemsung Wook drops the Reaper and then kills a Storm Breath with the Hero's Downfall. And yeah, that was that. Nam ends up taking his Reaper and just beating Mengucci with it. It was kind of bad. I really felt bad for the kid. I was sad that he fell off, you know, the face of the earth, basically, in this tournament. But the dude walks away. Every one of these losers, don't feel too bad for. They all got 10 grand. So, you know, they're fine.
and they're invited to the next Pro Tour.
Absolutely.
In retrospect, the Reaper of the Wilds seems really good against these green-red decks because, like, Polis Crusher, it blocks it and lives. Corsair Crucifix, it can get through that. Yeah. Sylvan Caryatid, it gets through that. Like, it's just super well
played. Everything else, it's a one-for-one with because of Death Touch.
It's right, basically exactly. A removal spell against everything else. It's just kind of sick. So, I mean, that's basically our quarterfinals, our semifinal. Okay, so we have Yuki Ichikawa versus Nemsung Wook as well. So now we know what our semifinals are. And so where do we want to start, guy? Do we want to start with Patrick Chapin versus Josh Utter-Layton, or do we want to go to Yuki versus Nam?
Well, let's go with the no-names first instead of the known names.
The no-names first.
I mean, that's a very, very broad statement in this top eight. I mean...
Yeah, this was a great top eight. I mean, names-wise, this was insane. So we have Nam Ichikawa versus Yuki... I'm sorry, Nemsung Wook versus Yuki Ichikawa.
Let's just call it NSW. We got NSW versus Ichi.
Okay, this matchup was a little strange. About midway through the game, Ichi gets a warning for looking at too many cards. Because what ended up happening was he got back a Corsair of Crucifix by killing a Brain Maggot and put it directly into play instead of putting it into his hand, and he flipped his card.
That's kind of sketchy. Like, at this level, like, knowing how cards work seems pretty important, so.
It does, but when you watched it, like, he honestly just thought, I thought it looked to me like.
I did too. I thought Brain Maggot returned it to the battlefield.
But it takes it from your hand, so, like, it would be a terrible card if it took it from your hand and you got it for free when you killed a 1-1.
Yeah. Really good. Yeah, yes. I mean, he was playing it like he would play an Oblivion Ring or something like that. That's kind of what he was thinking, but it doesn't work that way, so.
Right. So, oops. I mean, easy mistake, but kind of at this level, you expect better, so.
Yeah, you do expect much better for this. Eventually, Nam does pull away, with a Herald of Torment plus an Elspeth, while Ichi does nothing but draw mana sources. And it was really weird because the card that was on top when he got back his Corsair of Crucifix wasn't a Johnny. That very well could have played a huge role in this game by making that Corsair too big to deal with. And that was kind of sad. So Nam wins 1-0. Ryan, what did you think of that matchup?
I mean, again, I thought it was one that Ichi was definitely, I thought he was gonna be really favored to win this.
I wasn't sure what to think of Nam's deck in general, to be real honest. I think it probably got preyed on early by, you know, just, I mean, he lost two games with it in day one. I think he ran into that aggro early field.
And it was out of our four decks that had in the metagame that had more than 300 matches, Junk Constellation was one of them. Surprisingly, it was as little as we did see it, like on camera. It was obviously everywhere.
Okay.
But its win percentage at 47 leaves a little bit to be desired. I don't know. I think NSW was just, he played this tech exceptionally well, man. I think that showed it most in his Mengucci match. I know he was like praying for in game one against Mengucci for Mengucci to kill his Herald of Torment. So like it would stop doing damage to him. And that eventually the damage he took from his Heralds ended up killing. Like there was just some crazy plays, like things that could have been done. And NSW, the lines he took all day and watching him. it's no reason that he got the compliment he did later on, but. Yeah.
The one thing about Nam's deck that if you really looked at it where it was different from the other Constellation decks was his sideboard basically turned his deck into Chapin's deck.
His sideboard is so much, once he boards, it's a different deck. I didn't think, so game one, I was like, Yaichi's really favored here, but going into board, I was like, there's no way. The Reaper's just super good. I just didn't think,
Fleece Mains, just everything. It gets nuts. Ichi brings in Hunt the Hunters and Purphoros, and Nam decided he was going to switch to his more aggro build. And, game two, Nam Sung Wook got out the first Elspeth, which eventually went ultimate. Which, well, guys, you've been watching Standard for, the last 3 months or whatever. What happens when Elspeth goes ultimate?
Take 27 in the air.
Yeah, game's over. So Nam Sung Wook wins and moves on, best constructed player on MTGO right now makes kind of sense.
And I kind of have to disagree with Ryan, the fact that he thought that Sung Wook was kind of the dog in this matchup.
Game one, I think he was.
I'll take the game one. But in general, I think Junk was probably the best color combination for this format, because you have all the best removal, the best end game in Elspeth, and the best early game in Caryatid and Crucifix. Like, literally, this is the Jun deck of the format.
I think the pros definitely agreed with you there. Junk was, obviously one of the foremost played archetypes, but the fact that other pro teams went out of their way to try to next level the Junk shard by playing blue instead for Prognostic Sphinx just showed that, like, Junk was definitely the color combo to be feared.
Black-green was definitely the pair to be feared. It was just whether or not you wanted to go the Elspeth plan or the B Elspeth plan.
Yeah, and speaking of black-green, that combo, I was surprised at how little just black-green there was. I thought there was the tools there for some sort of graveyard-type black-green deck, but, it didn't happen.
Yep. Junk is
super fucking powerful. Like you said, it's got the best finisher in white, and it's got the best removal. It's got Thoughtseize, Hero's Downfall, and it's got, the color fixing that you need.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with that. I think Junk, realistically, in future Standard, is going to be a real player. Like, this is going to be one of the big decks. Normally you don't see... the decks like Bug Control, I don't expect that to be big in Standard.
We've been saying that Junk is the three-color deck that's going to pop up. We just saw Hoogland third place with one a couple weeks back. They asked Sapin, why do you play Junk? Why do you play this? And he said, it has the most bombs. That was his answer.
Pretty much. So we have...
Oh, sorry to cut you off there.
I was going
to
move to the next match. If you want to talk about the last match, go ahead.
Just something real quick. Junk moving forward, right now the Junk decks are utilizing the whip of Erebos and Obsidat. Looking forward, you're going to see more of a grindy mid-range kind of Junk instead of the huge bomb over the top Junk.
Yeah, it's going to be old school control Junk. Just rock. I got the answer to everything. You go fuck yourself.
Angelo, is this going to get you into Standard?
I'm already kind of beginning to dip my toe into it, playing all this recent block constructed, and this is my type of deck. This is the type of deck that's just like, I got the answer, and then I have a bunch of things that you have to have an answer for, or you're dead. I do enjoy these Junk lists. Like, these Junk lists are going to get me to probably, start doing some Standard play. It'll be kind of cool. So we have Raptor versus Chapin, Hall of Famer versus the 13th player in the world. This was an odd matchup.
Was this even a game?
Not really. Chapin is favored to start with. And Chapin gets out to a very fast start game one. Raptor misses a few early land drops, and that was the game. Game two was a very weird one. Chapin keeps a one land hand.
Yeah.
Okay. And Raptor keeps a two.
This is what I was talking about earlier. Yes. Yeah, because the crowd was going nuts. Raptor kept a one lander himself.
No, he had two.
No.
I have it written down.
They both kept the one lander. I'm gonna go right now to this matchup on YouTube. Keep talking. I'm gonna go right now and.
Okay, one or two, it doesn't matter. He stalls it too. I know that for a fact. Yeah. But Chapin, he keeps a black white temple and six cards. And like he said, sometimes it's better to be lucky than good, because he does get a turn 2 Fleece Mane. He does get a turn 3 Brimoss.
Yes, he ripped a forest, and then I don't even know what land he ripped turn 3, but it...
It was a plane, or Mana Confluence.
Mana Confluence, that's right.
And
yep.
Raptor never draws a third land, and he concedes the game. Which, Chapin wins 2-0. So we're going into the finals. It's Patrick Chapin, Hall of Famer. It's Namsung Wook, MTGO's Constructed Player of the Year. The numbers, you know, Chapin, if you just look at the pure numbers of wins and things, Chapin should blow this guy out the water. But after watching Namsung Wook play all day, you begin to think, wait a second, this might not go the way we think it's going to go.
Yeah.
So we look and, you know, cool. Let's start the best of five now. You know, for the title, they're back to the best of five. I really enjoy the best of five. I do think some of the other results in earlier rounds would be different had they been best of five, but they were best two of three. We have Junk versus Junk Constellation.
This just greater, like, reinforces the fact that Junk might have been the best combo for this format.
Yeah.
Just might have been.
Well, I mean, it's got Elspeth. That's all you need to know.
Okay, so, real fast, game one. Pat eventually gets an Elspeth to stick. And when I say eventually gets an Elspeth to stick, I mean, like, they were just killing each other's Elspeths. Right.
I think there were five Elspeths to hit play on five different turns. It was unreal.
Yeah, there was one game where it went insane. I think it was game three. But eventually, you know, he gets the damn Elspeth to stick. He ticks her up and ticks her up and ticks her up and just could not find a downfall that game. So Chapin goes up 1-0. They do some sideboarding. Nam is the first to land an Elspeth in game two. And it never dies. So, like I've said so many other times, if an Elspeth sticks on the board for a few turns, you are dead. 1-1, everything's tied up. Okay, you saw the first game, now post-sideboard, Wook wins. Wait, is Namsung Wook favored here? You're beginning to think this, you know? Game three goes in. Nam starts with a Thoughtseize. He takes a Fleece Mane Lion, and then he Brain Maggots away Hero's Downfall. This is not a good start for Patrick Chapin. Then so many Elspeths got played. Pat at one point had two. Namsung Wook had two, and these are in consecutive turns. And they just kept dying. And Pat got a third back after he banished a banish, got his Elspeth back, and two turns later, that Elspeth ended that game. Patrick Chapin, 2-1. So that game could have went either way, to be real honest. I mean, it really came off of the top deck. I mean, like you said, Mike, it was five Elspeths in five turns.
I mean, that's just insane. I think the edge, though, is Chapin with his two Glare of Heresy on the board for the Elspeth mirror. I think that's just a huge, huge thing. Like, it just gives him two more answers to that Elspeth.
It absolutely does, and it did show up. Game four, and you know, this is a shame, because I've seen so many Pro Tours end this way. And I'm just gonna say Nam stumbled to land a third land drop, while Pat sat there with a monstrous Fleece Mane lying, kicking Namsung Wook's ass. So congratulations to Mr. Patrick Chapin for, believe it or not, folks, his first ever Pro Tour victory.
Which I didn't know.
It's insane.
The innovator.
Yeah, he never won one. He's been in so many top eights. He's never won a Pro Tour. He's been close so many times. Never won a Pro Tour. And, you know, he was in the Hall of Fame without the Pro Tour victory. He's got it now. So no one can say he didn't deserve it. Cause I remember when he went in, people were like, well, he's never won one. And, you know, he's better known for the things he's done outside of the game than inside of the game. Those people can shut the fuck up now.
Well, and also in interviews, the big thing with Pat Chapin isn't a Pro Tour win. It's more the world's win.
Yes.
So the fact that winning this Pro Tour qualified him for the World Cup is more important to him. This was kind of like his day one for the World Cup.
Yeah. He called this tournament, and this is funny for, you know, a normal player to think, he actually called this tournament his PTQ for the World Cup.
Like, the I think back in, what was it, 2009 when, or 2007, when he top eighted Worlds and got to the finals with that Dragonstorm deck, he wanted that World so bad, and now he sees it in grasp again, and he's, I mean, I think he's just pumped. He's gonna come into the World Cup with so much adrenaline and ready to just destroy it.
Yeah, it's going to be crazy. Hopefully he can keep this run going. Cause, you know, when you hear somebody say, like, my dream has always been to do this, and it's somebody who's done so much for the game, like Chapin. You know, he does those things at the SCG Opens where you can just go sit there and listen to him, you know, talk strategy for an hour, which is actually pretty damn cool.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that a pro's willing to take that much time out of their day to just give back to the community, I think that's a huge thing. He's written 2 or 3 books now at this point. Like, the man literally loves Magic and the progression of Magic and seeing Magic grow. So I couldn't have, you know, wanted somebody better to win this pro tour.
Yeah, I hate to, you know, I know myself on a personal level, me and Will, you guys remember Will.
Yeah.
We went to,
Will, by the way, hang on real quick. I got to plug you, Angelo.
We can do that at the end of the show, man.
Okay.
I planned on it. So me and Will, we go down to, GP Cincinnati, you know, about a year ago. And Ryan, you were supposed to be there. But we brought a jacket for a Shaheen Serrani, which, you know, kind of fit him, but it actually fit Pat better. So Pat ended up wearing that jacket, and the power went out a few times during that day. And during one of those power outages, me, Will, Pat Chapin, and Shaheen Serrani sat there and just talked Magic for 15, 20 minutes. And you know what? When I look back on this tournament, watching him win this and everything, it's like, man, how are there better people out there I could have sat there and talked Magic to for 20 minutes than that? And it's just, you know, now I'm rooting for the guy more than I probably should. And that didn't actually hit me until like an hour after the tournament was over. I was like, holy fuck. Like, I know this guy. You know?
Yeah. And sitting there talking Magic with Chapin is kind of like sitting there talking baseball with like Tommy Lasorda or somebody. You know, he's been in the game so long and he has so much just experience with it. You can only learn by listening to him talk. I mean, I've talked to him a couple times. I talked to him at GP Detroit for a while and you know, it's just like the man exudes knowledge on Magic. It's unreal to just sit there and just take in everything he has to give on the game.
Yeah. I mean, just such a, you know, on the ebbs and flows of the game and the true, like, nuts and bolts of the game. He just has so much knowledge on that. Like you had said earlier, one of you guys did, he just does not make mistakes often. So if you're looking for him to make a mistake.
Super Chris, what I was going to say earlier that you probably edited out was after he took the throne, the King of the Hill seat from Mengucci day one to finish undefeated,
yeah,
I said he's winning this. He just, I don't know, man, there was something about his play, his confidence, like, dude, the guy's got fucking swagger all over him. He wore a fucking suit and tie in the top 8. Like, that's a class act, man. None of that grease.
You know what? I could care less about what they wear. I know you guys.
No. I like that he came and looked sharp and he took it down, you know?
I like that. But, you know, you guys, some of you guys in the Pit Ed's posse, I'm going to say this flat out. You guys just, you know, rag on people for what they wear way too goddamn much. I mean, let people be people. Why do you gotta fucking hate on people?
No, there's certain things that grown ass dudes shouldn't wear.
But who are you to judge what another person should wear?
I don't know.
You know what I mean? I mean, just stop judging motherfuckers. That shit ain't cool.
I'm gonna take a middle ground on this and say that people are people, but the people that take it professionally and take it seriously, you know, they show it. Like Chapin wearing the suit and tie, you know, he's there to make money. He's not there to play a card game.
Fair. I can fully respect a man coming in like that, you know, who says, look, I want to wear a shirt and tie, I'm coming to work. I can respect that. But at the same time, if somebody says, look, I want to sit here and be comfortable, I can respect that as well.
Yeah, that's cool. No one said anything about NSW wearing sandals and shorts in the top 8. I didn't put
it in. No, I'm just saying in general, it shows up on the posse page all the time about, you know, let's get these out. I showed up at GP Philly in sweatpants and said, fuck everybody.
I was just going to say,
if you were I make fun of the goofy shit that grown-ass men shouldn't be doing, like wearing Pokemon hats and hoodies that make you look like your fucking Jace the Monster.
Right. But this is my point. Who are you to tell other people what they should and shouldn't be wearing? Right. It's their life, homie.
Middle road again.
That's fair, but goddamn, man.
You can wear whatever you want as long as you don't smell like an old bag of Doritos. That's all I care.
That's bang on right there. Don't stink round 1. Look, I know there are a lot of people in there. You stink round 9 or 10. Okay, I guess I can kind of sort of accept it because you've been, you know, sitting in this conference hall sweating all day. But in round 1, do not stink. If you have buys, when you do come in, don't stink.
Buys is even more of an excuse because you have two or three extra hours to shower. Come on, people.
Yeah, don't stink. I mean, yeah, that's different. Like, you know, scrub your balls, scrub your ass. This is important. Every night. Not once a week, every night.
If you want to wear a button-up shirt with a bow tie and sweatpants and flip-flops and a fanny pack and socks, go for it. Just don't smell, please, God.
That's where I'm at with it, man. I'm what you
that's
like.
Cool, but I don't give a fuck. If you're wearing some goofy-ass shit, I will clown you. That's all there is to it. While you sit across from me looking dumb as fuck,
well,
I'm clowning.
Okay, I've been going to magic tournaments for a long time, and there are people that show up, and I expect them to wear the things they wear just for attention. Like the guy that's got the Dr. Seuss hat with the jean jacket with the poison shirt and cutoff shorts, he wants attention. That's why he's dressed that way. And
yeah, there's the dude that dresses like a penguin or something at a lot of SCG.
Oh, man, there's a lot of amphimorphs that show up for these. For those other people out there, those are called furries. I've seen people walking around with tails and fucking fox ears, and you're just like, all right, man, whatever.
And I mean, we're the type of community that's cool to let people be people. You know, you are who you are, whatever, we're here to play this game. You know, but like Chapin... And I know other people do this. I know Paul Rietzel's real popular for this. And just they are professionals at work, and they wear professional clothing because they're there to make money. I mean, sure, they're playing a game, but it's their job to show up, win, and make money.
I just thought he sent a message to the rest of the top eight, like, I'm here to win this. I'm the boss, like, shit with money. But yeah, I mean, all right, let's get off the clothes.
Okay, that was just a little rant I wanted to go on, just because I've been seeing it pop up on the Pit Imps page, and, you know, look, I want that to be open to everybody, and if people are on there judging
people... You know what? I'll stand up for the people you mentioned, because...
If you're on there judging people...
You gotta call people out. We got a perception and an image that this community's trying to fucking change. Don't come wearing your weirdo shit and fucking... You know, backtrack us. Take us a step back and shit, you dumb fucks. Like,
man,
we're trying to make this more, like, socially acceptable and, like, a more part of, like, everyday culture and shit. And, like,
so
when you're a 28-year-old wearing a Pokemon hat in public, like...
So what you're basically saying is stop being yourself, conform with the rest of society, accepted rather than making other people accept us for who we are.
I was going to say I have to disagree with Ryan on one point, the fact that, you know, magic community is the community that will accept anybody as long as you love magic.
Yeah,
you know,
that's a good thing about the community.
So who cares how somebody dresses? If they want to dress up like a monkey wearing suspenders, sure. As long as they play magic, love magic, we're going to accept them. You know, we might look at them a little funny because you're dressed up like a monkey wearing suspenders.
My head will go sideways too. I ain't gonna pop.
I was just standing up for those that kind of share those feelings on the page and stuff about dress code and shit like that. Is a way, like, I get that that's kind of their argument they're making, is that it's a perception on the community as a whole thing that they're trying to change. So that's all I'm saying, is like, there's people, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I get that. My issue is you're telling other people to conform
to
what society wants you to be rather than be themselves, and I don't think that's right.
And I'll agree to the point where everybody's entitled to their opinion, but as long as you treat everybody the same regardless, like, you can form your opinions on people, just, you know, treat them like a human being, not like the monkey wearing the suspenders.
Yeah, you're allowed to be an asshole and say whatever you want in the quiet of your own home, as long as it's not taped. You know? So, I mean,
how has this podcast been on for 70 episodes, man?
I have no fucking clue.
This is episode 70. Fuck, man. And way to do a Votor on a big episode. That's good timing.
Absolutely. So we have some conspiracy spoilers we're going to talk about here. They have a few of the things that, you know, seem kind of interesting. Like, we have a new thing, voting. What? Voting. Well, these are 4-player games. And there are cards that make you vote. And this one, Brago's Representative, while voting, you get an additional vote. So you're stuffing the ballot box. I mean,
I really like this card because kind of the conception of multiplayer is it's a very, you know, kind of diplomatic politics format. This just kind of adds to that feel. Like, you add voting in and you get extra votes, and it just makes it more political.
Yep.
Yeah, conspiracy's nuts, man. How that whole aspect that you're talking about, like, yeah, the voting and stuff. You can get people to play the bad guy, and you know what I mean? It's a cool aspect.
A-Ride, I know you got to take off. You have some pressing issues at the house.
Thank you for
staying for the whole Pro Tour. I really do appreciate that. Go ahead and give everyone your contact info and shit, so you know, and then I'll let you go, bro.
The Facebook page, Pit M's Posse, Twitter, Bro the Ryan, hit me up, Brother Yan, get at me. Also, real quick before I go, can I give like an anti shout out right quick?
Why gotta be an anti shout out?
It's a fucking anti shout out. This is big news in the community today. I wanted to give.
I know what you're talking about. Go ahead.
And because I talked about him already as being a weirdo, Cam Adkins, you're a fucking scumbag. Fuck you, dude. That's my anti-shout out. Thank you, Onar Bart, I mispronounced his name, but he's a member of the posse, Onar Barjor. He calls a lot of people out on this shit. Thank you for posting that and sharing that police report with the community.
The dude is a thief.
Yeah, way to put people on blast, man. The dude's a thief. That might explain why his entire Esper deck is foil. So just saying. But yeah, that's fucked up what he did. If y'all don't know, get on and read the story. John Kelso's posted about it and some other people. So it's on the page and whatever, but I just wanted to throw a fuck you out there to that guy.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and explain that after you take off, Ryan. Thanks again for showing up and everything. I'll talk to you next week, bro.
For sure. Mike, I'm sorry. I hate to leave early on you. It was a fucking blast talking to you and having you on. We will talk again for sure. I'm soon.
Sure, man. Sounds good.
All right, take it easy, guys. Take it easy.
See you, Ryan. So, Mike, you get to hang out and do a long one with me. The story Ryan was talking about is this guy got caught in the store that he used to work at, and he admitted to robbing it multiple times before in the middle of the night, and the police caught him and two other people this time, and this is an SCG player. You know, very prominent SCG player. The DCI, I believe, does have to step in with this one. If he's stealing all of his cards... You cannot let somebody like that on the Pro Tour. We do not need thieves. You don't need them in GPs. You don't need them in any event. We do not need thieves in events. We have enough problems with that. You know this guy's a thief. You can get rid of him now so nobody's saying, hey, that dickhead stole my backpack. Okay?
I mean, this is unreal. Like, grown-ass man stealing things. Like, I remember stealing candy when I was a little kid or something, and then, you know, you grow the fuck up and you realize that this is wrong. Don't do it. So people that do it for some sort of advantage just blows my mind.
Dude, if you're gonna go and rob like an armored car, I can understand that. But if you're gonna rob a place for some fucking cardboard, you're an idiot. You know what I mean? Like, why the fuck are, it's cardboard. Mike, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Okay. I mean, I don't understand, like, people, like, I understand these cards have a value, but, like, you work there. This is stealing from the person that pays your bills. You know, that's even worse at that point.
Yeah, I think they said at this point they had fired him due to suspicion.
Right.
And then he goes back and robs it again. Like, they already know you're fucking stealing from
him. This is like, all right, we have your picture posted on the wall, and you steal the picture off the wall. Like, come on, man.
Ah, so fucking stupid. So let's get back into the conspiracy, aside from the conspiracy we were just talking about.
Another new mechanic in conspiracy is called Dethrone. But I really like this because it promotes the multiplayer format. Dethrone reads, whenever this creature attacks the player with the most life or tied for the most life, you get a 1-1 counter on that creature. That's a super cool ability that kind of encourages people to attack, especially attack the person probably in the best position.
Especially this card that they put out, Archisa's Infiltrator. Oh my god.
This card is super cool. It's a blue and two colorless for a creature human rogue. It's an uncommon for a 1/1 that when it deals combat damage to a player, you draw a card. So first off, when you just declare your attack, the creature becomes a 2/2 for 3, which is, you know, Grey Ogre, perfectly draftable card.
Yep.
But then if it gets through, you get to draw a card. Well, that might seem innocuous at first, but the second and third and fourth time this thing attacked, I mean, you're looking at 3-3, 4-4, 5-5.
Possibly.
I mean, even if you're just picking the person that's in the lead because you just want to grow your creature, or worst case, you know, you have a 2-2 creature or 1-1 creature that gets through to the weakest person and you still get a card. Like, I really love this card.
Yeah, there's also another one here, Will of the Council. What this is every player at the table gets to vote on something. And this specific card is Tyrant's Choice, 1 black and a colorless. Starting with you, each player votes for death or torture. If death gets more votes, each opponent sacrifices a creature. If torture gets more votes, or the vote is tied, each opponent loses 4 life.
The only problem I have with this card is, like, it's either, like, a Diabolic Edict for everybody, or it's, like, a Flame Rift. Like, it's not super strong, but it is kind of a cool example of Will of the Council. You know, how many times you get to say with a magic card, vote death or torture?
Right. We're going to see Plenty Board upcoming week. And you want to go over this Salvalia's Charge here?
Yeah, this card is what they chose to show the third keyword of the set, which is Parlay. Parlay is actually, it's an ability word, I believe. This card, Salvalia's Charge, is a green and 4 colorless for a sorcery. It has Parlay. Each player reveals the top card of his or her library. For each non-land card revealed this way, put a 3/3 green elephant token onto the battlefield. Then each player draws a card. And I think Parlay is kind of the reveal the top card, get something for each non-land, and then each player draws a card.
Yeah, which is just fine. I get a bunch of elephants, and we all get to draw a card. I'm okay with that if I get 4 elephants.
Yeah, exactly. And it also kind of plays into the politics of multiplayer. You know, it's kind of like, hey, guys, we're going to look at what's on top. I get a couple things, but everybody gets a card, so don't kill me.
Yeah, but everyone's going to see what that card is, so which is really cool. We also have conspiracy cards, and I'm going to go with immediate action here. As our example of this, and we'll get into more actual spoilers come next week. I just really wanted to go over these things. Immediate action has hidden agenda. Start the game with this conspiracy face down in the command zone and secretly name a card. You may turn this conspiracy face up any time and reveal the chosen name. So you have to put a piece of paper, a stickum on it or something to write, you know, what the card is, because you don't want to be able to lie.
I think in the video they use little post-it notes or something, which is, you know, or just a piece of paper on top of whatever you need to do to.
Yeah, I mean, whatever works. Slide something in the sleeve that says what it is, but you have to write down what this is. And what you get for having this is creatures you control with the chosen name have haste.
Yeah, and we kind of touched on conspiracies earlier, but they don't have a mana cost. They don't have, like, instant sorcery, anything like that. It's literally a new card type called Conspiracy, and they act or they stay in the command zone. And, like, these with Hidden Agenda, you can reveal them whenever it's best for you, but some of them just start face up in the command zone. So it's all kind of card-dependent for what they are.
Yep, absolutely. There was a few reprints. We do know that this set has 210 cards. 65 of them are new, so 145 of them are reprints.
They didn't pull any punches with this one.
No, they didn't. I'll start with the first one. You can take the next one. We'll just go back and forth here. We'll go over every one of these because these are insane. We have Rout.
Back. Oh, man. I remember this card back in Invasion Block. This was Wrath of God that you could play at instant speed.
It's so stupid. There's over 3 mana and 2 white. Destroy all creatures, they can't be regenerated. However, you may cast Rout any time you could cast an instant if you pay 2 more to cast it. So for 5 and 2, Wrath of God. And this new art is amazing.
The new art. Unreal. Elish Norn calling down the light from above to just decimate her enemies. It's awesome art. I love it.
I think I just handed you the best spell, though.
Oh, man. I remember, okay, Mercadian Mask. Let's flash back to, like, 1999, 2000. Mercadian Mask comes out. I see this card in spoilers, and I'm like, what is this? Everyone knows Force of Will. But Misdirection is a reprint here in Conspiracy. It's blue 3 for an instant. All right. It says, change the target of target spell with a single target. Now you're thinking, like, you know, redirects a spell for double blue. What's so good about Misdirection? Well, you can exile a blue card instead of paying its mana cost. The Force of Will cost, if you will, to just redirect a spell. Like, free spells are good. Taking their best spell and throwing it back at them for free is even better.
Or just countering their own counter.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can misdirect their counter spell to your misdirection, which literally just says counter target spell.
It's absurd, man. This was a great card back then. Oh my God.
And the art's all right on this one. It's not the greatest. I mean, it's still good modern art, though. It's not, I mean, I think it's a little bit better than the old Mercadian Mask Switch Heads art, which is really weird.
Yeah.
But it's not the best art they showcase.
See, I really like the really old art and the new art. I don't like the middle section of Magic's history. Like, I loved it when, like, Braum was an artist.
Yeah, like the old, you could tell it was hand-painted, took hours to do, kind of the Therese Nielsen, Braum, you know, Doug Schuler, that kind of stuff. That's perfect. And then, like, the new, like, super, you can definitely tell it's Photoshop, but it
looks high-def digital stuff.
It's awesome. But yeah, kind of that middle ground, like the Invasion Onslaught, you know, you can't tell if it's hand-painted or maybe it's hand-painted with a little bit of digital you know, it just kind of looks almost cartoony.
Yeah. So the next one is exploration. You may play an additional land on each of your turns. And if you look at this thing closely, the picture on it, and this is for one green, this card is insane, but there are scale birds around this huge tower, if you look real closely.
Yeah, those little dots at the top. They almost look like stars, but they're scale birds.
Those are scale birds. This thing is big.
and it almost kind of reminds me of like the Zendikon in Zendikar, like the island with like the big floating island with the water running off of it.
Yeah, yeah. That's all I play in Limited is those lands. Specifically those ones that you're talking about where it has like the big, or wait, no. I use the one that looks like the
cup
turner. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Being up. It makes sense. And you want to take this last one that is, you know, insane.
All right. This last one was first printed in Odyssey. It was a little tough to play in Constructed because it requires so many targets, but in a multiplayer format, I think it's perfect. It's Decimate. It's 2 red green for a sorcery. It's a rare. Destroy target artifact, target creature, target enchantment, and target land. Now, the drawback to this spell is you have to have 4 legal targets to cast it.
Yes. Sometimes you do have to target your own stuff just to use this. But when you do, you know what? It's going to be good. If you have to pop off one of your enchantments or one of your little 1/1 creatures to get rid of, you know, there's so many good artifacts and enchantments, and you're always going to hit a land. Like, that's not the worry.
Yeah, the land's kind of like the plus one. And also, I like this art. I mean, it shows, like, these couple guys kind of running out of a temple and just, like, this horde tearing through it, tearing it apart.
Yeah, just going crazy. Goblins and,
like... It almost looks like the Gruul, like, tearing apart an Orzhov temple or something.
Yeah, it does kind of have that look. I'll go with exactly that's what it is. We're going to call it that. You heard it here first, folks.
Or maybe even Azorius, because, like, looking at these guys, they kind of look like, you know... Like with the blue, like kind of gems and orbs on their robes.
It reminds me of old school, Ravnica though. It looks like the Emperor Augustine era Azorius.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, it's definitely Gruul having a party inside one of their buildings.
Oh yeah. And they're just tearing shit up because why? That's what Gruul does. So, the next bit of news before we get into our basic rambling that we do at the end of every show, Vintage Masters, pre-release and release events, all the dates have been announced on this finally, and a bunch of the cool stuff that is going to happen, like price and things like that. Everyone's interested in knowing how much does these cost? Well, beginning on Friday, June 13th at 10 a.m. Pacific time, you can do pre-releases. And then after that, you know, the releases go. How much are these drafts going to cost? $25, folks. Tickets.
I mean, that's right on par with like Modern Masters when it was out. So, and yeah. I mean, these cards have way more value potential for these packs than Modern Masters. Like, sure, you can open a Tarmogoyf for a Dark Confidant, but that's nothing like foil Black Lotus. Like, that's literally free MTGO for a year if you open it.
Yeah, the 64 player drafts, however, you know, the Premier drafts, they are 30 tickets, and the sealed events are 45 regardless. Of whether it's a premier event or a regular event, $45. Go play some fucking sealed.
And something to kind of tie together the last couple pieces, like Wizards said that they're not doing Conspiracy on Magic Online just because it's kind of hard to do a multiplayer draft format on Magic Online. But their kind of compromise with it is a lot of the cards from Conspiracy will be making their online debut in Vintage Masters.
Such as Dak Fayden, yeah.
Yeah, Dak Fayden will be in there. Your pre-release promo card, if you play in the pre-release event on Vintage Masters, is Magister of Worth, which was spoiled, like, what was it, Theros pre-release when it, like, snuck into a pre-release pack as part of the Conspiracy promo. Like promotion,
yeah.
So that angel that lets you vote for life or death and like wrath of God or whatever, you know, that guy will be your pre-release promo.
Yeah, that's going to finish probably with a tie every time because you're going to pick what you want, they're going to pick what they want, and you're going to get what you get.
Right.
So this is going to be like a comes into play effect for most of the time.
Right. It's almost it's very reminiscent of like Desolation Angel where it's like you get a big flyer and then each player kind of like gets a negative, but you still have a big flyer at the end of it. So.
Yeah, I will say me being, you know, the sealed player and I like doing the sealed premiere events, 45 tickets. Now, yes, I have to do really well, you know, out of 128 players. But if you get first place in one of those, you get 36 packs of this shit.
Oh, man. And 36 packs, you're almost close to guaranteed to open a Power 9. I think it's 1 in 54.
Well, so you figure the 6 packs you open plus the 3 for the draft because you top 8ed, there's 9 packs on top of the 36. You're almost there. It's almost a gimme.
So what I'm saying, you know, at that point, if you take first place, you're almost guaranteed to get power, which, I mean, you can only imagine how many tickets that's going to go for online. So even if you're not planning on playing Vintage, there's so much value in these packs. It's probably worth just running it.
Right, right. Everybody in the pre-release will you'll get the badges they're worth. Like he said, the avatars, if you do a pre-release event, you will receive a Black Lotus avatar. And if you do a release event, you will receive a Dak Faden avatar.
Cool.
And yeah, they're going to have 8-4s, 4-3-2-2s, Swiss, and Sealed, and the premier events, and that is all.
I think this is their big summer promotion push for Magic Online. Like, this is the big thing to, you know, kind of try and hope everybody forgets about all the problems with Magic Online and come play, and play with super powerful cards with super cool interactions. You know, I'm really excited for Vintage Masters. I think it's going to be a fun time.
Oh, I'm going to play a lot of it, hands down. So, Mike, you've been on here now for, you know, 2 hours talking to me. And, you know, talking to Ryan for, you know, an hour and 50 minutes, roundabout, something like that. But, you know, who exactly are you, dude? Like, where are you from? How'd you find our show? Those type of deals.
Well, I'm from Dayton, Ohio, which is,
it's the gutter of Ohio.
Yeah, it's a decent site. Oh, well, hold on.
I've been to Dayton, man. I mean, there's some bad neighborhoods in Dayton.
Dayton's had its ups and downs. It's, I mean, but overall, like, growing up here, it's not that bad. It's no, like, there are parts of Cincinnati way worse, and of course, like, parts of Cleveland that are just even worse.
Okay.
Than that.
The last time I was in Dayton was probably about 8 years ago, and I was in the wrong part of town, man. Like, it was bad.
There's a couple wrong parts of town. I mean, if you stay to the suburbs, you're probably pretty safe. But
no, I was downtown.
Yeah. But I guess 8 years ago, downtown was a lot worse than it is now. They've been doing what a lot of cities are doing, trying to, like, kind of move the riffraff out, make downtown kind of like the destination spot.
So
downtown's getting a little bit better. But yeah, Dayton, Ohio, about an hour north of Cincinnati, you know, it's a decent sized city, but basically our suburbs touch Cincinnati suburbs. Eventually we'll be like Cincidayton or Daytonati or one of those, you know, just to kind of take over Southwest Ohio. I've been playing a whole lot of, like, computer war games where you're trying to take over the world. So,
ooh, like Civilization. I love that game.
The game I've been playing is Crusader Kings, which is, it takes it a little bit further back than Civilization, and it's more like a focus on the noble families than just, like, kind of, like, overall.
Okay, so you're looking at, like, Tudor's era.
Yeah, even a little bit before that, like, it's the game starts with the expansions and everything. You can start as early as, like, the 850s with, like, the Viking invasions of England.
Oh, sweet, sweet, sweet.
And it goes up to the point where, like, the Byzantium or Ottoman Empire, whichever you want to call it, collapses. So it's like 845 to 1445.
Okay.
So, and you get a whole lot of, like, the Crusades and, like, Catholicism versus Islam and, you know, but
just so you know, it's pronounced Byzantine.
Byzantine? Okay. Yes.
But I knew what you meant.
I think I got confused because it's Byzantine Empire or it's the Byzantium. So, yeah. But yeah, so, in general, you know, I've been playing Magic. I started in fourth grade, which should have been 1998. Like, Exodus had just come out when I started.
Oh, wow. So you're young compared to me.
I'm 27 years old, so.
Yeah, you're young compared to me.
But I started playing in Exodus, and one of my favorite stories is my first competitive Magic tournament. Okay, I went to, like, a Friday Night Magic before Friday Night Magic was a thing. And I was playing my awesome Endless Worm Rancor combo deck. Endless Worm, for those who don't know, it's a 9/9 for 5 mana. You have to sacrifice an enchantment during your upkeep or else sacrifice the creature. Well, Rancor got printed. I'm like, oh man, 1 mana? Keep this going? Yeah, I went in and lost the 4 Academy decks in a row. So.
Yeah, Academy was the deck back then. But that is a cool little interaction. Like, that's something that I've actually seen in EDH.
Right. And in EDH, you know, perfectly viable, but when you come in and people are winning on turn 1 and 2, your 5-mana worm probably doesn't do anything. So I learned at an early age that there is a difference between casual and competitive Magic. So I got pretty hardcore into competitive Magic in, like, high school. This is, like, end of Odyssey, beginning of Onslaught. Played a ton of Goblins and stuff like that. And then when Betrayers of Kamigawa came out, it kind of slowed down for me. I was ending up, you know, I was finishing high school, looking towards college. The set had been super powerful down because of all the Ravager affinity and all that, and Mirrodin was so overpowered they had to kind of, like, nuke the power level.
So, ban everything.
So I'm like, all right, the Saviors of Kamigawa set looks like crap. I'm just going to get rid of everything I own, get rid of Magic. And I was going to play Versus, which, those of you don't know, is a superhero card game. Well, come to find out, Versus tanked. So I literally got rid of my Magic cards and bought a whole bunch of worthless cardboard. Not one of my finer points in life. So, you know, I'm continuing with life, go into college, you know, do a little bit of that. And then I see, you know, on Facebook, one of my buddies is posting spoilers for Rise of Eldrazi. And I'm like, what the hell is Rise of Eldrazi? And I see Emrakul, and I'm like, okay, I gotta play this. So I start going back to the local store and getting into some booster drafts and playing. I'm like, this is cool. This isn't what it was when I left. So I start looking into it, and I see that I miss Ravnica and Time Spiral and Lorwyn and Shards of Alara. I'm like, man, I left at the wrong time.
Yeah, I liked every one of those sets except Shards.
Right. Like
Shards is the reason I don't play Standard. Like Jund came out and it was just like either you played Jund or you didn't play Jund, and I'd already dealt with fairies and it was just like, you know what, I'm tired of this.
I'll go into a little bit of that later, but yeah, I was like, okay, I missed some super cool sets, you know, but Kamigawa kind of turned me off to it. I'm like, you know, the whole Asian theme's cool, but they're kind of running it into the ground. Power level super low, I'm out. And then I realized I missed like Ravnica and Time Spiral and Lorwyn, all these super powerful blocks. And I'm like, all right, well, I better get back in before it gets too crazy. So Rise of Eldrazi, I start doing some booster drafts and the Scars block. I do a little bit of drafting. And then I see spoilers for Dark Ascension and I see Geralt's Messenger. And I'm like, I want to play zombies. Like that was what got me back into competitive Magic, was that mono black zombies deck that came out right at Dark Ascension. And I've basically been playing ever since at Grand Prix Columbus 2012, my first Grand Prix ever at Day 2. That got me into Modern. And at that point, I started buying into Modern. This was, you know, right, probably, what, 4 months after Grand Prix Philadelphia, where they debuted the format. So I got in super cheap. So Modern is definitely my format of choice.
Okay. So you live basically in the Cincinnati area. So I'm taking it you wasn't a listener when SCG Cincinnati was there.
The most recent one, probably, but the ones before that, no.
Yeah, this was like a year ago when the power went out like 6 times.
I was not a listener at the time. I do remember that event, though. I didn't make it because of some other things, but yeah, I remember there was like a real bad thunderstorm and like the venue was leaking and power kept going in and out.
Oh, it was bad, man. It was bad. Like almost died on the way home because, you know, the storms just followed me the whole way home.
Yeah, well, that's the thing about storms. They travel west to east, so.
Yeah, they do. They so do. It sucks.
But that Pittsburgh drive to Cincinnati is not too bad. It was about 4.5 hours.
About 4.5 hours. It wasn't bad at all. I mean, you think you're so far away because it's like, God damn, it takes 3 hours to get to Columbus. But then from Columbus down to Cincinnati, it's like an hour and a half.
Yeah, I just take 71 straight in. But I started listening because my last job I was at, I was doing delivery. I was delivering wine to 3 different states.
Sweet.
So I was on the road like 12, 14 hours a day. And I'm like, man, I need something besides this shitty morning radio to cope with the day. So I had just gotten an iPhone. I'm like, man, let's look into this podcast thing. And I started off with the basics, you know, A-Team, Mana Pool, limited resources. After a while, those get a little, you know, they're good, but you want some spice. So I started branching out and eventually I hit Pit Imps and I'm like, man, these are some crazy Midwestern guys that drink and talk Magic. This is sweet.
Yeah, that about sums it up.
I could completely relate. I think it was after you were on an episode of Monday Night Magic and I caught you and you pimped your show and I'm like, man, this sounds kind of cool. I'll check it out. And then I did the backlogs and everything and I'm like, yeah, this show's legit. I'll, and then I joined the posse and everything and I was like, yeah, this is fun.
Yeah, cool. You know, I'm glad you found us. It's weird. I do a lot of guesting on a lot of shows. And, you know, I usually pick up 1 or 2 listeners from each one of those shows, but it's still worth it because, you know, like, hey, you ended up on this show because I randomly decided to hang out with Chewy one night.
Chewy's super cool. I met him at GP Vegas. I mean, I've been listening to Mana Pool. Like, that was the first podcast I found when I started looking. And those guys are super cool. So, you know.
Oh, yeah. I love
Chewy. Shout out to the Mana Pool. Chewy's super cool, you know, and all the guys on the Mana Pool. Like, the thing that I hate about podcasts but love at the same time is you listen to them for so long, you feel like you're best friends with the people, and they have no idea who you are. So, like, you talk to them on Twitter, like, you know, using inside jokes and stuff, and they're like, who's this guy talking to me, you know?
Yeah, I will say that, you know, I've said it on this show before. Like, you guys know us. We don't know you. I mean, it's really weird because like I listen to a lot of podcasts that aren't Magic related and I feel like I know these people and you know, you would think that for me being behind the veil, I would know better than that, but it's like, I know everything about these people's lives. They just don't know fuck all nothing about me.
You know? Right. And I mean, I've noticed the same thing with like, if you get really into a TV show or something, you know, like me growing up, I grew up with the Harry Potter books. Like I felt like I knew those characters. And when they ended the series, it like felt like my best friends were dying, you know? And it's like, whenever a podcast goes off the air, it's like, man, I just lost a best friend. They have no idea who you are. And so the fact that you guys are taking posse members and throwing us on here, I think is super cool. Get to know your fans. Let us get to know you a little bit better. I mean, that's a really cool idea.
Honestly, that was the basis for the entire idea. It's just like, you know what? There's all these people that I talk to on Twitter. I talk to on the page. Like, I want to talk to these people and actually get to know them. That's why in like every one of these episodes, I've had a, you know, basically who are you section, unless it was somebody I kind of already knew. Yeah. But because I want to get to know you guys because, you know, I'm no different than any of you. I just want to hang out and shoot the shit about Magic. You know what I mean? I think that's cool. And more
drink
people
drink a little whiskey and talk our favorite hobbies, you know?
Yeah, a little bit of whiskey. I have problems when I drink too much whiskey.
I'm about 3.5 glasses in right now. I know exactly what you're talking about.
3.5? Come on, man. We're 2 hours into this. You should be more than 3.5.
I mean, I'm drinking straight up on the rocks. No mix.
That's how I drink it.
Yeah, man. You know, plus, you know, I have the awesome girlfriend that keeps bringing refills. So it's, you know, if she gets busy, you know, can't really say.
That is pretty cool.
But nutshell of me is I've been playing Magic for, you know, on and off 17 years. I'm a video gamer, artist, newly a writer. You know, just trying to keep myself from being bored. And that includes way too many hobbies that I can't afford.
I understand that. And speaking of artists, I need to bring this up yet again. Folks, you got like 2 weeks left. We have an artist contest. We want a new logo. $100 grand prize to the winner. I know I've gotten a couple submissions from Mike here. They're pretty good. One of them was an early front runner. I'm not going to lie. Like, I was like, this is it.
that was probably the first one I turned in.
I've actually gotten, you know, I ain't going to lie to you. I've gotten a couple since then that have kind of pushed you back in the loot. So you still have one more submission you can send me. And, folks, you can send me three of them. I want them basically by my birthday, and that's June 2nd. And then I'm going to record the next night, and I'm planning on announcing the winner. I might keep it open a little bit longer just to get a few more submissions. So if you're going to be running late on your submission, get a hold of me. Let me know. If nobody does let me know, I'm going to stop it that day, and I'm going to name my winner. It's $100 cash. I mean, look, I ain't rich, so if I'm giving out $100, like, this is something I want. And your picture is actually going to be on a shirt almost immediately. So
yeah, I mean, I could see you guys in the future doing sleeves, play mats, all that. But, you know, just to get a shirt out there for all the loyal posse members, I think it's a really cool idea.
There actually is a shirt. I'm not going to lie. I only have a few left.
I see. I didn't even know there was a shirt. So
yeah, I put them out at, like, episode 10 or 11. And we advertised them for, like, 5-10 episodes, and then we just kind of quit because I wasn't selling enough of them. And when I go to GPs or bigger events, I bring them with me and I dump them there. So I only have a few left, and most of them are not like extra large. So, but you know, if you wanted one, ooh, shit.
You there? Did you fall over or drop your headset?
Hold on 1 sec.
Yep.
Okay. So
2 hours and 45 minutes
drinking. so what ends up, if you want one after the show, you know, I can talk to you about it and we'll figure something out.
Yeah, sure, man.
But okay, aside from all that, what have you been up to recently, like magic wise, you know, just in your general life for like the last week that you feel like sharing with, you know, the rest of the people out there?
Well, like locally we have, I mean, I'm lucky enough to live in an area where we have like 10 card shops that have regular tournament scenes.
That's awesome.
So like, you know, just for a couple quick shout outs, we got Puzzles and Planeswalkers up on the north side of Dayton. There's Epic Loot, which is probably one of the best card stores I've been to on the south side of Dayton. This place is awesome. They're expanding here soon and opening up a video game section, like a separate store just for video games.
Damn.
And like LAN for like League of Legends and stuff, different stuff like that. This place got a huge gaming area. Highly recommend Epic Loot if you're in the Dayton or South Dayton area. You know, there are 5-6 other shops. But recently in Standard, I've been kind of bouncing back and forth between mono black aggro and a black green kind of constellation build I've been brewing with Eidolon of Blossoms and Master of the Feast and different things like that. Just a like kind of an aggressive mid-range type of black green deck.
Okay.
But you know, my heart and soul's in Modern. That's my favorite format. You know, basically I don't have the card pool for Legacy, or I'd probably like Legacy.
Oh, I love Legacy.
But as far as Modern goes, you know, I just happen to have the cards for it. And recently I've been kind of between blue red twin, kind of a tempo twin type play.
Oh man, it's a good thing Ryan's gone.
Right. I didn't want to say it when he was here because he might yell at me.
Oh, he hates that deck. He wants it banned so bad.
Locally we have a little bit more of a casual Modern environment, so I've been playing like a black green rock sort of deck, and I love that deck because it's literally a deck of answers, you know.
Yeah.
It's just whatever you're playing, I'm going to answer it and then play a solid threat, and you have to deal with it through all my answers. And it's definitely one of the more, I don't know, kind of fair decks in Modern, but it's still pretty powerful. I mean, anytime you have Dark Confidant, Tarmogoyf, Thoughtseize, Liliana in the same deck, it's pretty good.
Yeah, I've always been a junk player.
Like, I mean,
that's always been my deal.
See, you know, I'm the very nostalgic player. So like when I think black green rock, I go all the way back to like Urza's Destiny era when you had, you know, like the Spirit Monger and the, oh God, blanking, alcohol's kicking in, the pernicious deed and, you know, stuff like that to just kind of rule the board. And you had, you know, these real kind of cheap, dorky, efficient creatures that could, you know, advance your mana and everything. And it was so good. So that's The Rock to me.
Pernicious Deed, one of my favorite cards of all time.
I mean, literally.
We actually did a show where we said, you know, we went over like our favorite cards of all time and each color and all this stuff. It was like way back when. It was just me and Will. And our, both of our number ones were Pernicious Deed. So that just says it right there, man.
When that card came out, it was unreal. It was literally Nivinarl's disc that you could pick and choose what it killed.
Awesome!
But I'm such a nostalgic Magic player, which was kind of, you know, just recently. In fact, today being, you know, May 20th, I posted had an article posted on MTG Bro Deals. And I kind of wanted to pimp that a little bit, if it's all right with you, Angelo.
No, that's fine. I was going to give you time to do it.
Sure. My idea for this article, I was sitting around talking with a bunch of guys, and, you know, I'm super nostalgic. I've been playing for so long. It's like, we sat down, we're like, what has been the best standard deck ever? And we just kind of stared at each other for 5 minutes, like, I don't know, what is? So I got this idea for an article series where I take basically an NCAA basketball bracket. So 64 bracket, single limb down to the first. And I picked roughly four decks from each year from 1996 to 2012. And I'm going to throw them in a bracket. Me and my buddies seeded them. We had probably like a 6-hour discussion on how to seed these decks. And I'm going to put them into a kind of a tournament just to see what comes out on top. You know, we have our definite one seeds. We have our definite 16 seeds and kind of filled in the blanks in the middle. And it's going to be a lot of work on my part, but I think it's going to be a really cool series.
Yeah. You know what? I read your article today. It was interesting. I was looking at it. I was like, this is kind of cool the way he's doing this. You didn't get up as far in the years as I was waiting to see.
Right. And I was getting to a point where it's kind of like a good middle mark to like cut off. And I'm like, you know, I behind the scenes, I was talking to Jack, you know, content coordinator for Bro Deals. And he's like, you know, we really want a regular writer. So I'm like, well, this is something I can kind of milk out for quite a while if I wanted to. So I'm like, you know, I could do it all in one sitting, or I could split it up into two and kind of keep people hanging, give people a chance to kind of guess at what's coming up and everything.
Yeah, you know what? I write for them as well. I don't do it every week anymore. I used to be a weekly writer, but it's too much for me to sit down and do that writing every week.
Right.
So I've kind of backed off. I do, you know, like 3 articles every 3 months. So.
Right.
And usually bang, bang, bang.
And I'm, you know, unemployed right now in between jobs. So I have the extra time. So, you know, I told Jack, yeah, I can commit to it. But if you want, Angelo, I can give you a special spoiler of the Ravnica blog, like the Ravnica era decks that are on the list.
Ooh, a pit imp spoiler. Go
a
for it,
pit
man. I want to hear
spoiler.
These because I'm going to trash them.
Okay. Well, you know, this is at an era where I didn't play. So I just kind of looked at different tournament results and tried to pick the big decks that were there.
Okay. Now, when I'm going to ask this, when I'm saying Ravnica era, are we going Ravnica Kamigawa or Ravnica Time Spiral?
I'll do both for you. I'll start Ravnica Kamigawa era.
Okay.
All right. The first deck I have on here, which ended up being a 12 seed overall, I believe,
mm-hmm.
is the Greater Good deck that was, you know, top 8 at Worlds that year.
That deck was insane. I can't believe it's a 12 seed.
Well, trust me, it was rough. So that was a 12 seed. Another one off of this is it actually hit a 4 seed. This is the Zoo deck that famously Craig Jones top deck the Lightning Helix to kill, I think it was Antoine Ruel or Olivier Ruel.
Yes.
So that deck with, you know, Hound of, or Isamaru, Hound of Conda and Curd Ape and Lightning Helix and Char, that deck is a 4 seed in my bracket.
Wow.
From that era. Another one we have is the Heartbeat combo decks. This, you know, you might be familiar with these.
I am.
Heartbeat of Spring, Maga Trader of Mortals, basically a bug control style deck that just ramped mana ridiculously with Heartbeat of Spring to double your mana. And it played, Maga Trader of Mortals, which is triple black and X, drain somebody for X, and it gets X11 counters. It was kind of a mainstay from what I've researched.
Yeah, if you showed up in an FNM, somebody was there with it.
Right.
Just always somebody was there with it. Yeah.
And it saw some decent Pro Tour, like it top 8 a couple times, but yeah, it was, trying to find it on my list here. Heartbeat was a 13 seed.
Yeah, during the, years that you're going over right here, this is what I call the fairest time in Magic.
Yeah, like.
Because any standard deck could win any week because it really was a rock, paper, scissors. losers.
Well, and when I was doing this, you know, I tried to do four from every year, but when I got to the 03-04, which was your Ravager Affinity year, literally it was Ravager Affinity, Blue-White Control, and then decks built to beat Ravager Affinity. Yep. So I literally cut it down to those two decks because in a 64-player bracket, a deck that main decks four Oxidize and four Viridian Shaman is not going to have a chance against anything else.
Nope.
So I didn't think it was a fair representation of that era.
Okay,
so,
no, I was wondering that myself. When I only saw two there, I was like, yeah. Well, that really, I mean, there was like a couple other decks, but they were just keyed to beat, and that makes sense.
Right. Julian Naughton, who won the 2003 or 2004 Worlds with his green-white Astral Slide, the reason he won is he had main deck Oxidize
yep.
and four copies of Viridian Shaman that he could blink in and out to blow up their lands.
Yeah, Oxidize actually became a player promo, like, because they used to give cards out for just showing up to tournaments.
Right.
And like that was the one they gave out the one time, and everyone's like, oh, that card's so great. I'm like, no, it was great then.
Right, exactly.
It's garbage now.
So the compromise I made, since I only had two decks there, is in this Ravnica Kamigawa block, which you have dubbed the fairest time in Magic. There are actually six decks.
Sweet.
So, and the fourth one I'm going to spoil here is actually a 15 seed. It was one of the lower seeds, but it ended up, I think, winning a Pro Tour at the time, and that was Owling Mine. It used Ebony Owl Natsuke and a bunch of Howling Mine effects to kind of lock your opponent down and make them take a bunch of damage. It was kind of an innovative deck at the time because there were so many kind of slow, grindy decks in the format that it literally just said, I'm going to counter everything you play, you're going to have a full hand, and you're going to take damage every turn.
Yep, and Maloku's good.
Yeah, Maloku's so good. speaking of Maloku, one of the other decks from this era is the Izzetron deck, the blue-red okay. Tron deck, you know, big blue-red control deck, literally uses big man. Along with, you know, cards like Remand and Condescend, similar to the Mono Blue Tron in Modern, without the top end of Wyrmcoil and Karn. But, you know, it was a big control deck, used Maloku to just kind of, like, flood the board with guys and win.
Okay, so what about the next era?
Well, we got one more in this era, and that's the Black-White Aggro. Some have called it Ghost Dad.
I've heard it called Panda.
Yeah, Panda, Ghost Dad, Black-White yeah. Aggro. Hand in Hand, I've also heard, too. It was just essentially a black-white aggro deck that had kind of token synergies. The next era, which is the Ravnica and,
Time Spiral.
Okay.
This was fun. These are going to be the picks, man. These are going to be the ones I'm going to disagree with. I can see it coming.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to take feedback. I have the first pick I've made was kind of the obvious pick because it was so big at Worlds this year was Dragonstorm. The Spine Rock Knoll, or no, that was the later one. This one was the mana of like Rites of Flame. And Seeking yeah, Song and different stuff like that.
Snap stuff to get out all of your.
It literally, you just get Storm 4, cast Dragon Storm, go get four of the Hellkites, and just murder your opponent. Yep, that was the
edge to your face. Goodbye.
The next deck, which has become a bane of Legacy and Vintage, is Dredge. And I was amazed to know that this deck was so almost formed in Standard.
Yeah, like, it's good. It was good. It wasn't. As strong as it is in Legacy, but
it didn't
it's
have
good.
A card draw spells that it has in Legacy, like Breakthrough, yeah. or like it does in Vintage with Bazaar Baghdad, but literally it was every piece minus your card draw. It was in Standard. So that's the second one I have here. Third one is, it's a blue-white-red control deck. I've seen it called, like, Angel Fire. I've seen it called Blue-White-Red Blink. Like, it kind of depends on the build. Like, if you're going with the Bane Fire with the Lightning Angels and that combo, or if you're going with the Momentary Blink with other, you know, like, Court Hussar and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a couple different builds of it. That made the list. And the last one was kind of almost into the Owling Mind slot, but later on it became more of a mainstay, and that's the Pickles deck. The Brine Elemental with the
Pickles combo, yeah.
Yeah. Like, that deck, it popped up more and more, but, like, when it first came out, it was, like, four of each, and it was definitely meant to be, like, kind of almost a Stasis-type deck. But as it advanced, it became more of a control deck, which is kind of like, it had the option to Pickles lock you. So, it was kind of an interesting deck for that era.
Okay, here I go. Here's two or three that you're missing.
Okay.
Dranu Deluve.
Okay.
Okay, this was a deck, it was Time Spiral Ravnica, after Cold Snap came out, and the whole point of the deck was, the only creatures in the deck was, like, three Teferi. Dranu wasn't even in it, and that was a card from Cold Snap. It was in it for, like, a day, and then it got yanked out, but they kept the name.
Kept the name, yeah.
Right.
Just like the Rock deck, I don't know if you know this, but the Rock was originally, it was a Phyrexian Plague Lord and Deranged Hermit. And Phyrexian Plague Lord was the Rock, and the Deranged Hermit was and his millions, because you would sacrifice all the squirrel tokens to shrink your opponent's creatures. But the deck, to this day, still maintains the Rock.
Yeah, but you used mystical teachings to get whatever spell you needed, and you countered everything until you got a Teferi down.
Yeah.
And then you pretty much just locked down the board and won.
Yeah, I do remember seeing the mystical teachings type control decks with
that. Yeah, that was Guillaume Wafatafa was his big breakout deck that put him firmly as this is the control master.
And he's been playing control ever since.
Yeah, so there's that one. There's my favorite deck of all time, and this is going to sound strange. It's called Carson's Baby Bot Killer. It was a land destruction deck that thrived. It wasn't necessarily because it was in that era. It would have worked in any era because it used cards like Cryoclasm. Like, it was like, if you people want to play so much control,
I'm going to prey on that.
Like, I'm just going to destroy all islands and plains and just beat you. And blue white has always been big. So like, I think that's a card that just pretty much works in any era. Right. Plus there was Stone Rain. There was just so many cool things to it. And it actually led to Skred Red later
on. And both of those, Skred Red and the kind of like red green land denial deck, I saw both of those, but I left them out on purpose because of that Trinity green deck from like Urza's Block era.
Okay.
Because I didn't want too many land destruction decks, because if they got paired up against a couple control decks in a row, they were just going to run with it. So Trinity Green, it was, you know, it used like Guy's Cradle to make huge mana. And then
It was like infinite land destruction. Oh, I know all about that deck.
Tanglewire and Plow Under to kind of just control your opponent's mana. So I was like, that's probably one of the best land destruction decks ever, other than like the old, like pre-standard, you know, Stone Rain, Sinkhole type decks.
Yeah.
So I was like, that'll get to be our land destruction deck. So I left off that Cryoclasm, Skred Red type thing on purpose.
Okay, that was Karsten's Baby Bot Killer. Frank Karsten's came up with it, Hall of Famer. He won it was either a GP or a PT with it. And it was like, oh my God, this is so cool. Cause it really used some bad cards, but just preyed on things. Like there was a card called Stalking Yeti that just deals 3 damage when it comes into play. And it was like,
Cold Snap was an interesting set.
It really was. But yeah, so there's that one. And then there's this one, Magus Mono Green.
Was this the Magus of the Vineyard, and it's
yes.
Like Magus of the Moon, and just like literally
No, Magus of the Moon. It was just Magus of the Vineyard.
Yeah.
Groundbreaker, Timbermare. And it was really good against aggro decks because your things were just bigger. And it was really good against control decks because back then we had this thing called Mana Burn. And any would make control decks either play something that they didn't want to play out of their hand because everything was, you know, counter that until I can play something and then continue to counter everything you play. Well, Vinny was like, I'm just going to stick 2 mana in your mana pool every turn. So you're going to take 2 damage every turn.
Well, I remember you used to play Mana Flare as a drawback for decks that weren't ready for it. Like, because you would tap your land for mana and get double. So, like, you would tap 3 lands and you only have a 5 drop. So you're taking 1 damage at the end of it. Like, okay, this is the culture shock I went through. When I left in Kamigawa and came back in Zendikar, this was post M10 rules change. I sit down for my first draft. I block something and try and put damage on the stack, and the guy looks at me like I'm a moron. Like,
yeah. So I understand that.
I had the giant culture shock of coming in after the M10 rules change and like, what else is different? So, yeah.
No, that's cool. Yeah, those are the only decks I would recommend for it. It was, you know, for that era, obviously this is a cool idea. You just got a little piece of it here. Go back, read last week's episode, get ready for next week's last week's article. Get ready for next week's article. Follow this. This is a really cool idea. I'm glad that you found, you know, my brothers at the Bro Deals. I'm still on the email list, so, you know, I'm actually still a part of it.
Yeah, and, like, when I came up with the idea, I'm like, who am I going to get to publish this? I'm like, this doesn't seem like something that Star City would be interested in or something like that. I'm like, well, Jack's always saying they need writers, so I'll message Jack. And he's like, yeah. He like, jumped on it. So I'm like, okay, I found a home.
On my site, too, but you know what? You'll get more readers on Bro Deals.
I'll tell you what. If you want to put, like, a mirror of it up, if Jack's cool with it, I'm cool with it. You know?
Oh, I'm sure Jack wouldn't care, but you know what? You'll get more readers on Bro Deals. Just stay there. I'll get into what I've been up to now. Earlier this week, I've been playing a fair amount of block, just because, you know, I'm trying to dip my toe in a standard for fuck's sake. But obviously I played a bunch of sealed. I played a bunch of drafts. And why did I do this? Because I was sick for a week. I had a sinus infection. So I wasn't going to work. So I'm just sitting here from Tuesday of last week until Monday of this week, I didn't go to work. So I was just sitting in front of my fucking computer all day.
I remember seeing your tweets that you got sent home one day because you tried to go in and he's like, nope, get the fuck out.
Yeah, pretty much. He's like, I don't want everyone else getting sick. Get the fuck out of here. So I get into this, Premier Sealed event and I'll just read my rares. I got the Hydra Broodmaster.
Not bad.
Okay. Courser of Krufix.
That's double green rare. You're looking good already.
Hero's Downfall.
Green black.
Silence the Believers.
Definitely green black.
Yeah, I just went green black. Like, that was the base of the deck, and I just housed everybody. Took that fucker the whole way down. I was so pumped.
Oh, that reminds me of my Born of the Gods pre-release, when in my pool, I opened 6 out of 7 of my rares were white. I had Brimaz. I had Hundred Handed One. I had... I mean, it was nuts. I was like, yeah, I'm playing white, and then I just have decent red removal. And I'm like, yeah, I'm in.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, I had threats at every level, and it was just like, okay, I gotta kill that Nessian Asp, I gotta kill this, I gotta kill that, holy shit, there's a Courser Krufix, I gotta kill that. It just got so out of hand to where it was just like, you know what, eventually I would just get a Hydra down, and I was at so much mana, and the key to the deck really was the, what is that, Market Street, I want to say, where you tap a mana for 3?
Yeah, the 4-mana enchantment that enchants the land, and you tap it, you get double of a single color.
Oh, man, when you're dropping that Hydra turn 5, people just do not like that.
Is it Market Festival? Is that the name of it?
Yeah, and it's like, you know, immediately after that, my Silence of the Believers would be so turned on because I'm killing 2 things, and then, like, I still have this huge Hydra that is just going to get bigger the next turn, you know. It just... So much fun to play that. I mean, it did have, you know, good success in general. I won a couple drafts, you know, I bounced out of a couple drafts early. But dude, that sealed deck was so much fun to play with. Like, it is funny because most of those, 3 of those cards were big deals in the block format. So it's like, okay, that kind of makes sense now. I won.
Yeah. I didn't get a chance to talk about it during the Pro Tour coverage we were doing, but Silence the Believers, it reminds me a whole lot of Sever the Bloodline from Innistrad, but it's an instant. Like, Sever the Bloodline was a 4-mana sorcery, killed everything plus everything with a name. Well, for 4-mana instant, you exile anything, and then for 3 extra mana, you kill something. Like, it just seems like a huge player in Standard going forward.
Yeah, if gods see play, which is a big reason why I don't think you saw a lot of gods in this format, was because of the fact that
you had Silence Deicide.
Deicide, Silence the Believers. I mean, if you actually turn that god on, you've messed up.
Yeah.
Because Silence is just going to get rid of it. So, but yeah, that's basically been my week because I've been sick as fuck. Do you have any shout outs you want to give?
Shout out first off to you and the now absent brother Ryan for inviting me on. Thanks to the Dart for choosing me. It's been a lot of fun casting with you guys, getting my voice out there for the posse and everybody else. Thanks again for letting me come on.
No problem, man. You've done an excellent job tonight.
Oh, thanks. I've been on a couple casts before for like video games and stuff, so I'm familiar with the format, but you guys make it super easy to kind of just like meld in, feel like I've known you guys forever, like I've talked about earlier.
Cool.
And, shout out to you guys. Shout out to the posse for being so cool on Facebook. I mean, every morning I wake up and it's like, I have the little Facebook world icon with like 7 on it because the posse is super active. Come in, throw in my points, you know, everybody's super cool. It's like a big family of rejects. But we're fun, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. You can tell when I get up and when I go to work and when I go to bed because it'll be like, you'll see 3 sections where, like, when I wake up, I check them all and then I respond. And then when I get off of work, because, you know, I have 10 more on there, it's like, fuck, okay, I'll check them all and I'll respond to the ones that I want to respond to. And then, like, before bed or before I do the podcast or something, I'll check them again and I'll respond. It's kind of funny. Like, you can tell my whole day just by looking at how I respond on that page.
Right.
But it's so active. You have to respond every day or that number is going to keep ticking up on your phone.
And it's unreal because I, like, had, like, 2 days where I didn't check it and I go back and I'm like, what has happened while I've been gone? You know, it's just like so much stuff is posted. Like 3 people have new posts that have like 30 plus comments on them. Like the posse is the family to be in for a podcast fan club. You know, it's literally like, I think we're giving the heavy meta SVU a run. I mean, I know they're huge and super like zealotrous and, you know, just all about heavy meta, but I think we're a close second. You know, we just have these guys that are diehard. We got each other's backs. It's such a cool group to be a part of.
Yeah. This podcast wouldn't have made it past episode 20 if it wasn't for the posse.
Oh man.
And it just continues to grow. It's a beautiful thing.
And one final shout out for me, and that's to MTG Cast. I think they get a lot more flack than they get credit. The fact that they post up everybody's shows, no questions asked, really, bringing content to everybody all these weeks. I mean, if it weren't for them, you know, I would have probably fallen asleep and crashed and died in a car a long time ago. They provide so much entertainment for no cost. You know, if you guys got an extra $5, throw it their way as a donation. I don't know if they're still taking donations now that
they actually do not.
Okay, I was about to say, ever since the takeover when Quiet Speculation bought the company. I wasn't sure if they were doing it, but if anything, you know, just send a shout out to like Jason Ault or Quiet Spec, you know, on Twitter. Just tell them thanks for taking the time to post these shows and make sure you have podcast content every week.
Or you can just give Jason Ault shit because that's fun.
Yeah, I mean, he seems like the kind of guy. Just tell him that the Chicago Blackhawks are the worst hockey team and, you know, he'll be your best friend forever.
Watch the rant ensue.
I mean, I'm a hockey fan, which is kind of awkward in Ohio because our only hockey team that is professional is the Blue Jackets, and they're horrible.
Hey, so, whoa, they weren't a bad team this year, man.
I'll say it.
Going forward, they're going to be dangerous. Like, they have a very good nucleus to that team. That's going to be a good team in the future.
Yeah, you know, 3-4 years, they're going to be a competitor. You know, I think Rick Nash was holding them back because he was taking up so much cap room. They couldn't bring other good players on, so I think that was a good move of them to kind of get him out because he was, like, the only name on the team.
Yeah,
so,
I don't even think it's 3-4 years. I think next year and the following year, like, they're going to be they got the goalie. I mean, they have fast players that want it.
They're growing, that's for sure. They're definitely getting better. But like the last 3-4 years has just been kind of a joke. So
yeah,
hockey in Ohio is kind of not a thing, but we have local teams and stuff, but I've been a hockey fan for a while and, you know, just to see you guys kind of bantering back and forth on Twitter has been pretty cool.
Yeah. In Eastern Ohio, it's a thing.
Yeah.
Those Pens fans.
Yeah. I was gonna say, Cleveland, Youngstown area, those are all Pens fans. And then once you get up in Toledo, they're all Red Wings fans. So.
The Cleveland people are not Pens fans. Youngstown, yeah. There's nobody in Cleveland likes anything that has to do with Pittsburgh. And it's vice versa. It just is what it is.
Cincinnati is pretty anti-Pittsburgh, too. I hate to break it to you.
Oh, I know. I'm okay with that because, you know, we've kept them out of the playoffs in football for...
So you got the Steelers-Bengals and you got the Pirates-Reds that don't really like each other either. Oh, but the
Pirates-Reds do not like each
other. It's unreal how rivalries start. You know, it's like, sure, we're neighboring states and we play each other twice a year or whatever. But it's like, you know, if you look back at the Steelers-Bengals, you know, like you have like the Carson Palmer that the Bengals say it was an intentional shot to the side of the knee by the Steelers. And, you know, you got all these little...
From a former Bengal, by the way.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is the thing that always has fucked me up about that. But you know what? Your pitcher did throw at McCutcheon. Like, I'm just putting it out there, man. He threw at him. Like, there was no reason in that game to throw that ball up in his head, and he did. And when you throw 106 mile an hour, you know what? You can't throw at people.
Right. And you know, I'm not one to, like, support rivalries, but there are a couple that I have to stand by. One's the Ohio State-Michigan. You know, I'm an Ohio State fan. When it comes to, you know, late September, early October, and it's like, oh man, football's in the air. It's like anything Michigan can go away. But like come January after bowl season wraps up, it's like, all right, Michigan's cool again. And the other one is I hate Bill Belichick and the New England Patriots. They can all die in a plane crash and I wouldn't care. I mean, the fact that the guys got caught recording people's practices for an advantage and got a slap on the wrist and lost a first round draft pick the year they won the Super Bowl. It doesn't really seem like a big enough penalty for basically the closest thing to cheating in the NFL you can get.
So guys, guess what his favorite football team is?
Yeah, I'm a Jets fan. I've been that way. Okay, I started off Bengals fan when I was a kid because my parents were. I really, really latched on to Boomer Esiason for whatever reason when I was 3 years old. And he eventually got traded to the Jets. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm a Jets fan now since I like Boomer Esiason. And I got to the age where I'm like, well, I should follow a team, not a player. And I just stuck with the Jets. So I've been through the Parcell years, you know, with Curtis Martin and all that goodness. And then I've been...
Pitt graduate, by the way.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, I got family in kind of the Pittsburgh area, Salzburg, in that area.
Okay, that's south of me, but yeah, I know the area.
Yeah, and what is it, like Pitt University, there's a little prep school that's in Salzburg that's, you know, put out a bunch of talent in football. You know, I really like Joe Namath. I think he was a Pitt graduate.
My hometown.
Yeah, so, you know, being a Jets fan, Pittsburgh's not that bad in my book. You know, you guys
shouldn't be. We gave you your best wide receiver you've had in years.
Oh my God, Santonio Holmes, no. Ohio State gave us that wide receiver.
No, the Steelers said, we don't want him anymore. Jets, come get him. You like shit like this. And they was like, okay.
The Jets have had a bad reputation. Not as bad as like the Oakland Raiders for picking up trash, but the Jets pick up kind of some older players sometimes, and I question every time.
You know what? I won't lie. I used to be a kind of a closet Jets fan, but then they got Rex Ryan, and I just do not like that guy.
Okay. The last thing on the Jets, I promise. Rex Ryan is a great defensive coordinator, should never be a head coach.
Valid. I will go 100% with with that. The dude is not a head coach. Any more shout outs?
No, I mean, other than like, you know, friends, family, people that probably will never listen to this, you know, if okay. you do, thanks a lot.
All right. I got a couple shout outs. One, I need to give one out to, Three Kings Loot. They're the people who sent me my free Mana Confluence. Uh-huh. And then I get a message from them, you know, cause I said, you know, I brought you up on the show. They was like, yeah, we listened to it. You know, thanks for that. And we can't wait to, you know, even if it's only a couple customers, we can't wait to help out the Pit Ends family. So, they said they was going to take care of us. I don't know what that means. They are from Canada, so if you're in the United States, it takes about a week to get your stuff from them. But if you're from Canada, let them, and you order from them, let them know that we sent you there. They said they're going to take care of our fans. I don't know what that means. So,
I mean, even if it's 5% off your order, that's better than nothing. You know, like even the smallest little thing that they can do is better than absolutely nothing. So I really, appreciate when stuff like this happens in the community, people looking out for other people because of shout outs and stuff. I think that's super cool.
Yeah. So, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, those are good peoples. If you don't mind waiting to get your stuff and you're in the States, give them an order. If you have a week or two before you absolutely need it. And if you're from Canada, you need to order from these people. These are good people. They took care of me. They gave me a free Mana Confluence because my name popped up on some randomizer, and that is awesome. I also need to give a shout out to Ruben, Sid, Calvin, and Hakon. They're working on some project that they keep asking me questions about how to podcast.
I think this is the fan cast that they've been working on.
Yeah, they're putting together a Pit Imps fan cast, and this is awesome. I think it's great. I'm going to continue to bring it up until the first episode is out. Guys, thanks. Flattery. I mean, honestly, I'm flattered by it because, you know, like they tell me this would have never happened if it wasn't for you, which yeah, everybody met in the posse. So in a way that's true, but in a way I'm like, I created a spinoff. Come on.
So, I will stand by my statement. The posse is the greatest podcast family out there.
I love them, man. I absolutely love them. Every one of them. I also want to give a shout out to Will. Will was kind enough to sit down with me before he went on his, before he decided to fly to fucking Atlanta to walk home. He likes to do the hiking thing, as you know, a lot of our listeners know. He's hiking home from Atlanta, but before that, he sat down with me and we recorded an episode of The Imps Prison, which I have kept on hold for a while, almost probably a little over a month. And the reason I did that was because I couldn't think of any way to end The Imps Prison than with him.
That's a super cool way to go out too.
Yeah.
End with the beginning.
Yeah. He was, you know, the original, he was the original co-host of this show, and he quite frankly is my best friend. And you know, I don't want him to get too far out of there where everyone forgets who he is. So I had to bring him back on for an episode of that. When he gets back from his trip on the trail, he's probably, if he's still in the right place that he was when we recorded that, he's going to come back on for an episode or two of this. And I can't wait to have Will back for that. So it'll be really cool in a couple months when he's actually home. If he can sit down and do one of these with me and Ryan, that would be great. But yeah, I want to thank longtime listeners of this show. You have no excuse not to go back and listen to that because Will is an awesome dude and you guys know that. Short-term listeners, you need to go meet who the original co-host was.
Definitely. Will's a super cool guy. I remember listening to the backlog and catching some of those episodes. And for anybody in the posse that hasn't listened to The Imps Prison, I was a little skeptical at first, but after the first couple episodes when you had like Chewy and Jack on, it's not a magic podcast. It's just, let's get to know these guys, hear some cool stories. And like the Clues episode, I re-listen to that like probably once every couple weeks just to learn something new every time I listen to it.
Dude, everybody loves that one. Like, I plan on doing a season two next year. Like, Clues, that is the only guest that is etched in stone that I must have on because people will fucking riot if I don't have him back on.
I mean, he's the Neil deGrasse Tyson of the magic community. So the fact that you have him on is the closest thing to having Bill Nye in your lap that, you know.
And you know what? It's really cool too because like I do know a lot about astrophysics.
Right. And you can definitely tell listening to the episode.
I was able to really bounce some crazy things off of him and some questions that, you know, maybe your average person wouldn't know. So, like, I think, you know, people did get to learn something from that. And at the same time, Clues is so excited about physics that it's just super cool.
He's like that high school physics teacher that like gets up there and starts like pacing back and forth because he's so ready to teach you about physics. Like that's what I picture every time I see Clues because I've seen him at a couple events judging and he just is like, he's just like this ball of like potential energy ready to explode. He's a physics joke.
Oh, he's great. You know, I've never actually met him in real life, although, you know, we've talked obviously on podcasts multiple times.
Yeah.
And I thought I was going to get to meet him in Philly, and then he's like, yeah, PAX East is that weekend. I'm like, God damn you. Like, we need to sit down and just like have lunch together and, you know, hang out and talk.
I met him very informally in Vegas, like after I met Chewy, and me and Chewy were talking for probably about 2 hours, and he's like, have you met Clues yet? I'm like, no. He's like, follow me. And we go up to the desk, and he introduces me to Clues, and Clues probably didn't remember me, but yeah, I met Clues in Vegas.
So. That's cool. I know when Chewy came to Pittsburgh, pretty much for 2 days, it was, if I wasn't in a match, me and Chewy were hanging out. Like, that's my dude, man. Yeah, that's our really cool dude.
I'll tell you what, you gotta FedEx me some Permanente brothers, man.
Oh, well, you know, hey, next year we're supposed to get the GP. Pennsylvania gets one every year, and
it's every other side, yeah.
Yeah, they flip flop the side, so next year we'll have that, we should get the GP, and you can just come here, play some cards, eat some Permanentes, and everybody will be happy.
Swing my terrible towel.
Yeah, I kind of plan on having a party too, so you never know.
Sweet. Yeah.
I mean, this could be a good time. If you wanted to get a hold of Brother Ryan, you can find him at Bro The Yan, as he said earlier. And also, folks, get on the Pit Imps page. Go into your Facebook browser. Hit the search bar. Hit Pit Imps Podcast in there. Send me a request to join the group. Typically, I get it within like 2 minutes. If I don't, somebody else will. We will put you in there. As long as you're not a complete asshole and you're not spam, because we've had problems with spam, we'll let you in the group and keep you in the group. If you want to get a hold of me, you can get me at Gongsu on Twitter and on MTGO. If you wanted to grind some block constructed games with me, you know, I'll try and burn you out. I don't have a problem with that. You know, I've been playing a lot of red. I'm not going to lie. you can also find me, once in a while on MTG Bro Deals, as well as, my buddy here, Mike. And you can, is there another way? Oh yeah, yeah. PitImpPodcast@gmail.com. You can send me a little long form. Mike, if people wanted to get a hold of you, find you, or read your articles, how would they do so?
Well, my article is posted, it seems to be, according to what I think, it's going to be every Tuesday or Wednesday on MTG Bro Deals. You can find me on the Posse. Mike Hardy is my name on the Posse. I post pretty occasionally on there. And then also, if you want to follow me on Twitter or talk to me on Twitter, it's at mhardy, that's M-H-A-R-D-Y, 1987. Just toss me some comments if you guys just want to talk. I'm usually pretty bored outside smoking a cigarette, so just hit me up.
Okay, well, Ryan's not here to do it, but next week what we're going to do is we're going to go over GP Atlanta. We're going to do SCG Somerset, which is in New Jersey, not PA. And we're going to go over more conspiracy spoilers. I'm going to try and get a actual podcasting guest on for next week. You know, unfortunately, the Posse thing has kind of ended. We'll do it again. I do want to get to meet all of you guys, but, you know, let's get the numbers up a little bit, and maybe I'll do it again when we hit 200. I don't know if you've noticed that I started it when we hit 100. So when we get to 200, maybe I'll do it again where I do another run of episodes. But hey, Ryan's not here to do it, so you're gonna have to do it, Mike. Until next week.
Until next week, everybody. Have a great week and go fuck yourself.
That's not what you're supposed to say. You're supposed to say fuck yes, Scandinavia.
Fuck yes.
Have a good one, folks. Go fuck yourself.